Welcome back to the Tetracast, RPG Site's official weekly podcast. We are at the end of July now, July 26, 2025, as of this recording, at episode 405. I am your substitute host, Josh Torres. Your usual host, Brian Vitale, is currently having a good time at a Renaissance Fair. I'm a little bit jealous. I haven't gone to a Renaissance Fair in a very long time now. Joining me on this episode is Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
Chao Min Wu.
How's it going?
And Mikhail Badnani.
Hello.
So this week, to round out the relatively quiet month of July, for RPGs, new RPG releases, we did have like a brand new action RPG come out with Wuchang Fallen Feathers this week. We also had Wild Hearts S that came out. Oh, actually, is it out? I forgot. Did it come out?
I think so. Yeah, it came out.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, it came out on Switch 2. And then I'll be talking a little bit about Pokemon Friends as well. There's a new Pokemon event this week. Came out. Check that out. So we'll start off with Wuchang Fallen Feathers. This is a pretty interesting project. It is, as I mentioned, an action RPG from a brand new studio, Lindsay Games, who's based in Chengdu. Kind of has, you know, when people think about this project, there's going to be some natural parallels to last year's Black Myth Wukong. It's a Chinese-based developer, and then like their first kind of big debut console game is this kind of ambitious Souls-like-esque action RPG. Wuchang Fallen Feathers, my review will be up probably by the time this podcast gets published. I'm just about finalizing it. I think everyone here has at least touched it besides Adam, so we'll have a lot of a discussion about it here. And I've been spearheading it with a review. Mikhail did some testing on it, on how it runs on devices like Steam Deck, ROG Ally, etc. Chao, you've been playing it as well and beat it along with me. Before I get into my thoughts, I want to, you know, since you also beat it as well, Chao, I want to hear like your initial impressions from you and what you thought about it overall, and then we kind of go around and see what we thought about it. So before I get to myself, I want to hear from others first.
When I first played it, I had a pretty weak impression of it. I felt this was like the weakest Souls-like, but as I get more deeper into it, I seem to kind of like it from all like the hard boss fights that I got. I don't know why. That's just kind of like my experience with it.
Yeah, so to kind of set the stage, like this kind of a pretty interesting Souls-like in the sense that like it's takes in a pretty like pretty unique time period for where video games are taking place. Like this is set in the late Ming Dynasty in ancient China, and it's kind of characterized in a pretty brutal way with a lot of like decay, slaughter, corruption, kind of. Everyone's getting fucked over, whether it's from this disease called the feathering or whether it's through ongoing political conflicts already happening. And like you said, like this is a pretty difficult game. Like I also got my ass kicked too as I was going through this game. Like I think in overall, I think this is harder than Black Myth Wukong and even Kazan earlier this year from First Berserker Kazan.
That's pretty wild to think about, because I actually didn't fully beat those games, or I haven't even touched Kazan, so I don't know what to compare with. And the last Souls games I probably like fully finished was probably Bloodborne. That's quite a long time ago, right? I didn't beat the original Dark Souls. I'll be honest with you. I just basically stopped playing every time when I got to Blight Town because I just don't like those places. I think they're torturous. You know, it's just not fun.
What kept you going for this one? Like, what made you push through with this one that you think, you know?
I think the levels are not that difficult, to be honest with you. Like, navigating to new areas is just not a pain in the ass. You know, I just hate swamps in most Souls games. Like, as soon as you get to a swamp, everything's designed to be a torturous slog. And this one doesn't have that. I can just get straight to the boss fights, which all I care about, right?
This is not, like, mission-based like Neo. This is, like, interconnected world design.
That's yeah. kind of it. You can just kind of go this place and that place. It's actually pretty linear in like how the design level is. Like as soon as you get a key, you know you're where you should go, right? It's kind of like it's very straightforward, despite how it looks, right?
Yeah, I agree with you.
Is there a map?
No, not at all. I mean,
true to the genre. So,
but it does have like a thing when you go to like a shrine, it'll tell you that there's an NPC there, so that way that you can, you know, look for the area. But it doesn't tell you exactly where it is. So I couldn't finish some of the quest lines because I don't know where the hell the NPC is. Like one of the time, it's like when I reach to the snow place, Cloudspire, it says that the old lady is there. And that's part of, like, a quest line. I don't know where the hell the old lady disappeared to after I gave her, like, the steam bun or something like that, right? I was looking for her for hours, and I was like, oh, fuck it, I'll just continue the story, right?
So, for two questions. One, are quests... Is there, like, a quest log, or is it more you just remember who you talked to and where they what they said?
There's no quest log. There's no quest log. It's more, yeah, it's kind of weird because there's no quest log... But if there is a request from someone and you're in that quote-unquote quest line, there are, when you're doing fast travel in between the shrines, that menu that pops up has the, like, the heads of people by, like, a location to remind you, hey, you might have something for them or you're currently doing a request for them. So there are reminders for you through that, like, NPC's, like, head portrait.
Yeah, Liza P does the same thing. And I'm not very well versed on Souls games, admittedly, but I know Liza P did the same thing. So, mm-hmm.
So
Liza P. It's very Liza P.
Mm-hmm. And I do like that the you were mentioning Chao, like the world layout and design. I really like. I think some of the enemy placements in those are deliberately there meant to like kind of screw you over, like how. You know, Lords of the Fallen when it first launched had many complaints of like, hey, like it feels like at every corner there's like someone ready to like push you off a platform. Like there's definitely some zones where there are some deliberate enemy placements that are meant to do that to the players, which, you know, it's not the best, but that's not a common design philosophy throughout the game, which I like. I'm glad that's not the whole game. It would have been a slog.
Yeah. Like, it'll be like playing Dark Souls 2, which is like, oh, why is there like a billion enemies here? It's like, even if this game wasn't like a good Souls, it's still better than Dark Souls 2, sorry, right? So, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I got friends that wouldn't
Which is play funny, any Souls. Because I'd say that of the Dark Souls games I would compare this to the most, I feel like the first two Dark Souls, especially 2 actually, if some of the stuff it does
with mechanics. Yeah, I think it does too, yeah. I think of 2 a lot too. So, the most I get, I think, like the one mechanic that really sticks out to me that is most like Dark Souls 2 in this is like when you use a health flask in the game, the way it's very slow and deliberate, and you do have like a really slow crawl walk when you do it. It's just like the feel of like using a health flask in this game is very Dark Souls 2-esque.
Like, yeah, I do agree with that part because I actually barely heal in a lot of boss fights. Maybe that's why I die a lot because like, a lot of the time it's like, try to heal, gotta get fucking murdered.
The bosses do input read you in this game very. When you're looking for it, it's very obvious that like they'll deliberately delay or not do anything until you like tap the button to heal. Then they're like, okay, I'm charging at you. Get screwed because it takes a lot longer to actually do that. You're healed, like you're locked in animation.
Yeah.
Quite a while. Before we get any deeper into that, I want to hear from both Mikhail and James on their experience and how far they've got into the game. So, feel free to just kind of hop in and tell us like your initial thoughts and what you think so far.
So, I haven't played all that much yet because I've been juggling a few other stuff and transcribing stuff. Like, I put about like 5-6 hours into Wuxing. I've done 3 boss fights, so I'm not that far, but I have been enjoying what I played. I can't speak to the performance because I haven't had any issues, but apparently that's been a major concern. Like they did like a hot fix and something.
Yeah, that's kind of the one of the when this came out, this game has consistently received like. Broadly like negative reviews and you know from a lot of people in the West who contribute to those reviews on Steam, like the one of the main pain points is the PC optimization on this. I didn't have like constant issues, but when they when they occurred, it was real bad. For example, there's like there were memory leak issues in the second half of the game. So like there'll be some bosses that like I was stuck on for a while. I had to keep on retrying, do the run back there. And it would continually raise like my swap usage as I'm like doing the retries. So there was at one point where on the way back on the run to a boss, it actually did a hard crash out of memory because my swap usage maxed out. And then I had to restart my whole computer because it like kind of fucked up my desktop too alongside that. So from then on, I had to like be extra eagle-eyed over how much of this game was like eating my fucking VRAM and the swap usage on it. And that wasn't fun. Other than that, you know, I'm on a 3080 5900X. So, you know, my expectations are in line of like what settings I could do. So it's like a lot of my playthrough is like
I'm concerned that a game would even be touching your swap file at all. That's not good.
I mean, it's not fun. So, and then I had to go mainly like mid settings, middle settings, 60 FPS cap, and you know, to kind of smoothen it out as much as possible. And that it ran okay for the most part, but I did not like, obviously, when that happened. And of course, an issue that everyone you know, faces in this game is also the stuttering, whether it's constant or maybe just a little bit. Like everyone will face stuttering in this game.
Yeah, it has that classic Unreal Engine traversal stutter.
Yeah, so
it also seems like that even though they compile shaders, there are a few that got missed. So there is some shader stutter, but it's not as bad as some other Unreal Engine titles. But it is there.
Yeah. Mikhail, how about you? Like in terms of just like just initial impressions when you first as you're playing it, and like any performance issues that you're
facing. So like if for those who haven't read the article, initial impressions were a little I don't know what to say. So when I installed the game on my Steam Deck, it did not boot up. So I spent the next like I think 2 hours trying different things, trying different Proton versions, trying it in desktop mode, trying to use a launch command to make it seem like it wasn't on Steam Deck. It just would not start at all, whatever I did. So I was like, okay, this is probably either too big for Steam Deck or they've put in something which just will not let me run the game on Linux or Steam OS. So I got it working on the ROG Ally. And this was pre-day one patch. The day one patch actually like helped on handles quite a bit, but I'll get to that. So on ROG Ally, this is one of those games where you have to like run it at the absolute lowest settings, running it at 25% render scale, putting every single setting off or low. And then I was getting just about 30 FPS. But the problem with that is I ran into a lot of Unreal Engine, like just traversal stutter. So whatever settings I used, it just had constant hitching to the point where I was just not having fun playing it. So I wrote down whatever impressions I had. I started putting together my article. And then the day one patch went live, like I think a day and a half before embargo, or maybe 2 days before. And this changed quite a bit. So it actually booted up on Steam Deck. Some more graphic settings got enabled, because what happened before is it was forced into Unreal Engine's temporal super resolution TSR. So now I could actually use FSR. I could like enable frame generation. Obviously, this is not a game to enable frame generation on with PC handhelds, because it runs at such a low frame rate in the like from the start. It's just not worth doing. So with the day one patch, it kind of is the same as I'd say Black Myth Wukong on ROG Ally. It's still not playable because of the hitching, but if they can address that to some degree, I can at least say that if you really want to play it on a handheld, you can like get it working. And there's one thing I want to ask James, actually. So when I looked at the minimum requirements, it's one of those games which needs 6 to 8 GB VRAM and 16 GB RAM. Would something like this help with or mitigate the Unreal Engine stuttering? Because
Because traversal stuttering, it's the way that works is that there's parts of the game where they've coded it to load in assets, but the way that it loads in the assets causes a very like short frame drop that manifests as a stutter. So, like, no matter how much VRAM you have, it's going to do that loading in new assets. It's kind of the same reason why you have those stutters in Monster Hunter Wilds if you have the HD texture pack, because the way they're handling it.
Yeah. Okay, so, like, after the day one patch, it got to a point where I can say, like, the thing is, with these Unreal Engine stutters, the VRR on the screen also wasn't helping. Like, there was nothing I could do to mitigate this, so... Even if it was, like when I ran it at the absolute lowest settings, it was hitting, like, 50 FPS also, but it just did not feel good because it was stuttering. And, you know, I just, like, it's hard for me to comment on how the actual PC port is because I'm specifically testing on handhelds. But whoever I spoke to who got the game on day one, like, everyone has been running into these issues, and it's kind of unfortunate because the game hit, like, I think 150,000 on Steam, and it might even go up, like, by the end of the weekend. Like, we're recording this on Saturday morning. It might even, like, go up, but then the performance issues are, like, dragging it down. It's, like, mostly overwhelmingly negative on Steam right now. And they've already pushed out 2 updates on Steam. I don't know what's happening on the console side with updates, but the current state of it on Steam is, like, they probably need to do a lot to fix this. But yeah, beyond that, I think whatever I've seen of the game and whatever I've played of the game so far, I like it. I was going to actually buy the soundtrack on Steam because I liked it, but I think they've changed it so that everyone on PC who bought the game gets the soundtrack for free, but this does not affect review keys, so it just shows me as not available for the soundtrack or something. But yeah, that's like, it's at a point where I was considering picking up the game on PS5 because that's 100% going to be a better experience than playing on PC handhelds. But I got a little busy with some other games right now, which one of them we'll talk about in a bit. But yeah, that's where I am with Wu Chang on PC right now. It's just, don't even bother trying it on Steam Deck right now. If you have a ROG Ally and you can play in the turbo mode, you can give it a shot and see how the stuttering, if it affects you to the point where it's not playable or not. But it just bothered me way too much, so I just gave up on it.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. It's very understandable. Yeah, one of the things I do comment on my review is, like, I really like the soundtrack of this game. I think I wonder where you fall in this, Chow. Like, there's such, like, a unique vibe to this game. There's, like, a poisonous, mystique, like, an intoxicating, haunting atmosphere it creates that, like, I don't really see many games get quite right. There's something about this game that I just really like. I like the chilling atmosphere of it. There's something very menacing in, like, in the seams of it, and it really, really shines when it comes to, like, really some of the, like, the monstrous boss designs of, like, how skin and flesh like morphs and disforms, and the way that, like, it's kind of disgusting, but it's, like, in a way that it's hard to get your eyes off. It's like, oh man, there's something real bad going on here, but that is one hell of a monster design you've made in this game, and the way that it animates and moves, and the way that you have to kind of adapt on the fly on the way that it unnaturally attacks you is, like, it's really, like, when I think about this game, I really view it under the lens, like, this is a debut studio's first game, and I think it's really, really, really impressive what they created under that lens. And I really like a lot of, like, the traditional Chinese instruments that they use in it throughout its soundtrack, like, just like the I'm sorry if I mispronounced these, but, like, the Dizzy, the Erhu, the Suona, like, these different, like, Chinese instruments that, like, you don't really hear in other, you know, sort of, like, games get utilized in this game, and they're not afraid to switch entire genres of an OST, but it's, like, going to, like, a boss's second form, the whole track will just completely change on the fly to, like, sometimes a different genre, like, whoa, what is going on, you know?
I do feel like the later soundtrack sounds a bit too Final Fantasy-ish. I sort of got, like, when I was fighting, I think it was the tiger. It sounded like hearing a Final Fantasy 16
OST, right? I like that it's so varied, though. I love that it's so varied. It's like, it's something that I don't really expect from the game, but then they just kind of, like, they kind of pull it out, and you're like, okay, sure. Like, why not?
But yeah, I definitely think the soundtracks is fine. I do find one of the interesting thing is I actually did stream like near the end of this game to a friend, and she had a hard time reading like some of these words, and she literally had to look up the wiki. And her first language is Chinese, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, I think she was trying to like watch it because she heard this game is being very controversial in China right now. Mm-hmm. But it's not because of like what's happening in the game, but because of the pricing over there or something like that.
This
is, like,
I heard charged
a lot higher.
Yeah, I heard they like changed the pricing in Chinese territories in that game kind of almost last minute, which caused a lot of continues to cause a lot of controversy in that game. Like, I don't know what's going on, and they even acknowledge it that they're looking into like what's happening there. So,
for the record, here it's $50 for the standard edition, $60 for a deluxe edition that I think has a few like costumes, right? Mm-hmm. And it's on Game Pass, isn't it?
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
So yeah. So it's not quite full price here.
So I noticed this thing in India, the game was listed at like 2,700 rupees a long time ago. Like when it went up for pre-order, it was 2,700 rupees, which is not technically regional pricing, but it's not bad pricing. So what I did is whenever I see a new game come out, which is kind of hyped, I just tell any friends who might be interested in thing, you might want to pick it up in case they raise the price, because that's happened with a few games in the past. So what happened with Wu Chang is it started at 2,699, then it went up to 2,999, which is still not bad, but after it released, they bumped it up again to 3,150 for some reason after they commented on the price thing. And what makes it weirder is if you buy the base game and you buy the deluxe pack, it's cheaper than buying the deluxe edition because of this price mistake thing which is going on with them. So I don't know when they're going to address this and how it'll work with refunds and stuff. Like the amount isn't that much, like 200 rupees or 150 rupees isn't that much, but I just don't know why they randomly raised the price after launch. But they raised the price for the deluxe and standard, not for the deluxe upgrade, which is still the same price. Like the review code which I got was the game with the pre-order bonus, so I just bought the deluxe upgrade to like do my DLC guide for the game. And yeah, like I'm happy with it, but then I don't know what the deal is now, because people who want to buy the game now, I've just told them, like, buy the standard edition and buy the deluxe upgrade. That's cheaper than buying the deluxe edition. So it remains to be seen if this is something they'll fix. But yeah, there has been a lot of controversy with the pricing in China, which has led to a lot of negative reviews there, because usually regional pricing over there makes games a lot cheaper than buying them for people in the West. So I guess in this case, I don't know if it was a publisher or developer without, like, asking each other or, like, without any consultation how it happened, but it's something which they need to address. And I don't know if they'll have to talk to Valve to offer refunds for like people who've played for more than 2 hours, because those things have happened before, right, where Valve has stepped in and given refunds even if people have played for a long time, and then people can either rebuy it or not. But we'll have to see what happens over there. But yeah, they said they definitely like commented on this specifically on the Steam blog post, when they've also been posting about the PC updates.
And on that note, the publisher is 505 Games, which has a pretty varied like catalog in the last couple of years. But you know, I don't know if the pricing issue is something on their end, or maybe just I have no idea. But I just wanted to note that the publisher is 505 Games.
Considering they're like one of the few publishers that has still been taking like Epic deals. In fact, they were the ones that published Blades of Fire, which was completely exclusive on Epic, which I just say is a weird choice in this day and age.
Yeah, you don't see that very often.
Chao, I'm interested. What was the build that you settled on?
I settled for the longsword. But before we get to the topic, I just wanted to mention one of the words that she had trouble reading. Do you remember like this? A lot of the lore is about the bow people, or I don't know.
It's like the The spelling is B-O, so I assume, for at least for our Western tongue, it's pronounced bow, but I don't know how.
Yeah, she can't read that word, so she like wiki it up. So it's basically a extinct tribe that's kind of like the Chinese type of Aztec type people, right? They're extinct, right? And they're kind of like known to like put like coffins hanging on a cliff. So they're kind of the people that did that. They're like, but apparently, like in late Ming Dynasty, I think the Ming Emperor like freaking like genocided them because they didn't pay their taxes or something like that, or some fucked up reason.
Oh, but God.
That's like kind of like the lore of those guys, apparently. Something. But anyways.
The game definitely does touch on like pretty dark subjects all around. They don't shy away from like kind of characterize like how like a lot of fucked up shit happened in during that era. Like there's like even in the set dressing, like there's frequently you'll run into cannibals. You'll see like human meat boiling in soup around a campfire.
Pretty gross,
disturbing stuff.
Like I don't know. Like it has like that plague atmosphere. I was thinking, like, did you touch that the Hungry Lamps yet? It kind of has the same idea about the plague and you know, diving deep into cannibalism because the lack of food, I guess, right?
That was like one of the like you know peasant rebellions was like one of the main driving factors you know characterized that period.
Yeah,
when the Ming Dynasty fell.
But yeah, so I just want to say, like, one word you couldn't read was that. But yeah, I did went to the longsword build. I know you discovered some crazy build at the end, but it wasn't really useful for the greatsword build because there's this magic attack where you find at the end where it lets you auto dodge a single attack, and it recharges your Skyborn Might, which is like this magic charge if you perfect dodge something, right?
Yeah.
And it's kind of useless for a longsword because one of the skills I was relying on is the parry, which is the sword counter. And the auto dodges overwrite the dodge. So it was kind of not useful for the build I went for because I like to parry the stuff because I find the parry is actually the most broken tool in this game. I had certain trouble against certain bosses, and the parry worked out really good. So at least that's a build I went for. And I also discovered that some of the bosses that you can't really beat until you like kind of discover their trick. Like when I fought the mistress, I literally died for 2 hours against this woman because I can't counter her with parry, but if you try to attack from the front, she also like parries your attacks. So what the hell do I'm supposed to do? Dodge her attack all day? And it turned out you could just run behind her, fully charge her attack, and then it stuns her, and you could do a liberate strike, which is this version of the visceral attack from the Souls game, right?
Yeah, this kind of has like an interesting mechanic. As you said, there's a whole cadence to combat that's like leans on the more aggressive side compared to like some other Souls likes. Where your primary defensive tool is a dodge, but certain weapon types do have like a block and parry option to them, but they're fairly limited. You're encouraged to dodge or dodge often to build up the Skyborn Might resource to activate your weapon abilities or spells, but then there are some other alternative playstyles where you do rely more on a block parry mechanic for some weapon categories. And one of the main like aspects of combat that you can utilize if you want is like for humanoid enemies that if you're constantly either maintaining aggression on them, like kind of keep on hitting them so they don't have a chance to like kind of breathe, or hit like their backside, you're building up like this poise stagger meter, circular meter. It's not like the main focal point of combat. It's not like a big stagger bar underneath their health. It's like by your lock on reticle, there's like a small semicircular meter that fills that when it fully fills, they go down and you can do like that obliterate attack, I believe is the term in this game, where you can do like, you know, a good chunk of damage and then the fight continues. But I do like that that's not the main focal point in combat like some other action RPGs these days, where like you have to stagger them to do your burst damage. Like the game will dictate when you get to like actually do substantial damage in the game. Like in this game, you make your own openings. Like the enemies will be aggressive and they have aggressive attack patterns deliberately, because they, like that's how you gain your resource to gain your offensive resources to do your spells and weapon abilities. So that's why they kind of constantly attack you. So in return, you have to really decide which openings you want to utilize, and that's a case by case scenario. So, like in your case, you have attacks that I would stay away from because I don't do a block deflect build. I do I did a life leech temper, like there's a temperance system in the game where that you can use a consumable that refills at like the checkpoint shrines that you can infuse your weapon with like a different element or a different like status buildup. So like when you hit something, they'll get like more burn or more blight status. And then there's one that I got, this needle that I can put in that temperance consumable, and that will put life leech on my weapon. And I had benedictions, which are like little like talisman stones that you can slot into your weapons. And I was able to get the perfect trio that massively buffed my stab damage. So I put that on a spear and continued to buff the hell out of the stab attack stat on that spear, because you know most of the time when you're playing a spear in the game, you're stabbing dudes. So I put on that spell that auto dodges for you, and you get the Skyborn Might MP back, and with Life Leech, so I could continue kind of wailing on dudes, getting health back, and if they try to attack me, I'll auto dodge. It lasts very, very short until like the next time, but you get that resource immediately back to cast it again instantly. So I barely have a hitbox at the near like the last stretch of the game, and just in case I take damage and I'm running low on health on resources, I have Life Leech to kind of get more health back while I have an auto dodge state on me. And that was my build for the back half of the game, and that felt crazy because I was also already doing like really good DPS because I was stacking my stab attribute so much on it. And that was my answer, and yeah, we found two different answers, and then everyone's gonna find a different answer for them. Like some people are messing with magic builds, some people are messing with the other weapon categories, and
I know people are really liking the clash for dual blades.
Yeah, I've seen that as well for people. Yeah, there's also like other mechanics, like the clash mechanic, where there are some parts of like either weapon abilities or attack strings that like if an enemy attacks you during that part of that ability or string, they will clash with you instead, so they kind of bounce off of you. But it's a very, very brief window in which that clash attribute is in effect for that, which is really cool. There's another cool thing in the game that they put, like this madness mechanic, where you Wu Chang, your protagonist, as she dies continually or takes certain consumables, or her madness numerical value will go up, and eventually she'll enter this madness state, where she deals more damage, but in return she takes more damage, which is a fairly basic risk assessment on its own, on like whether you want to enter this madness state or not. But being in madness state also enhances the properties of like certain abilities or your attacks. Like this is a whole skill tree system that you engage with, and some of the nodes are there on there like for weapons are like, I know in the one-handed sword tree, which is like primarily like your magic weapon. If you want to do a magic build, you do the one-handed sword tree. One of the first basic nodes in when you start that tree is that you occasionally get like Skyborn Might just by wielding a one-handed sword. So sometimes you'll just get MP for free that you can use whatever you want with. Eventually, as you're stacking more MP, the Skyborn Might, because some spells and abilities take 2 Skyborn Might, some take 3, etc. But there's a node on that tree where it's like if you're above 90% madness, then your Skyborn Might, as long as you have 3 stacks of Skyborn Might, it will not decay as long as you are in 90% madness and you have at least 3 stacks of Skyborn Might. It will no longer decay, because normally Skyborn Might will go away if you don't use it after a certain limited amount. So that's like an interesting way of like preserving a pool of like MP to cast your magic on if you're doing a magic build. Like having a reliable MP pool is very important for that build, which is like, that's an interesting way of like utilizing that mechanic. Like, oh, okay. That's something to consider now. Like, hey, maybe I should try to keep in this madness state because I can stabilize my MP pool in that process.
One of the things I find in this game, I feel it's completely useless being not in the madness state. It's like bosses like literally one shot you or two shot you. You know, it's like, why not just take more damage? You know, it's like you have way more benefits playing in the madness state. I think this system's a bit poorly implemented, in my opinion.
I don't think it's poorly implemented because there's some benedictions that you get, like you benefit from like being at full health. Like if you're at full health, you'll do more of this. If you're at full health, you'll do more like more damage or you'll stamina recovery speed. Like there are benefits for like, you know, trying to mitigate damage and like trying not to stay out of madness. Like obviously when you're trying to learn a boss, you don't want to die immediately every time. So like being in a state where you're taking less damage to at least learn the bosses, like to live long enough to learn the boss's attack patterns is beneficial to you. Sometimes you just don't want to be in the madness state because you're trying to learn a specific boss and you want to live long enough to at least see like what phase two of a boss looks like, you know?
I don't know. I just find the boss hits way too hard in this game, even with it off. So that's kind of like, I just played the whole game with madness, and it's like when I lose madness state, it's like I tried it. It's like it doesn't make that much of a difference. I was like, I'll go back. It's like invoke, artificially put my character back to madness state. That's kind of like my way of playing this.
I mean, it's a game flexible enough to kind of incorporate all like any playstyle, but that doesn't mean that it will be easy. You know, it's a game that, you know, it's very challenging. It'll demand, you know, skill and mastery over whatever you decide. And the nice thing about it is you're not locked into like a single weapon type or build or anything because it has free unlimited respec. It's very easy to kind of respec from one build to another because when you reset the node that branches out into the rest of a weapon's branch on the skill tree, it'll refund every single resource that you've used on that entire branch. All the souls that you use to get those nodes, all the essences to get those nodes, and all the items that you would have used on masteries, you could use that on another tree and then try out another build entirely, and all that sort of stuff. So it's a game that also makes it very easy to experiment with other builds on the fly. You don't have to like, it's not a massive time commitment to kind of respec in this, and it's not like, hey, you don't need a key item to respec. It's like, no, just fucking go for it. And that's cool, you know. I appreciate that a lot as well. I respec like three times throughout my playthrough. Explore.
I think I respect when I was fighting the commander because I was using a spear and I did not find any luck using a spear against the commander. And then I switched to like the sword. Like the one-handed sword, and it's like the game was telling you about like deflexing clashes, like when you fight her. So I'm like, okay, maybe they wanted you to do that, because why would they give you a tutorial just like at a boss fight, like now, like midway through the game or something? You know,
that's definitely, I think that particular boss fight that you're thinking you keep talking about is like, that's definitely like the first like big major hurdle for a lot of people. Don't feel like, you know, you're too bad at the game. It's like everyone will have their own personal like demons in the game of like, there'll be bosses that like people will struggle with for sure. But and I just, you know, I just think overall, like the game is solid. It's not like overly superb or like a masterpiece, but it's a really solid game. You know, it's solidly not solidly optimized, but like in terms of like world design and layout, it's well put together. Traversing those environments is interesting, and just gameplay overall is pretty well thought out because you have so many tools at your disposal, and you get like especially the back half of the game. That I think one of my main criticisms as well is like I think a lot of the fun stuff that you in that game is kind of too backloaded. I think in the first two thirds of that game are like it's okay. Like you do get like some interesting power ups and spells and stuff, but I think the last stretch of that game like gets really, really crazy with what they give you, and like it's really cool, and I kind of wish they found a better way to spread that more evenly than kind of locking that for like probably a new game plus playthrough or something effectively. It's all right, you know. The story itself isn't anything to write home about to me personally. It's like I think it was really weird, and I don't know if you caught this, Chow. The very first interaction with the NPC in the game, the Taoist priest, that is the only time Wu Chang, the character, the protagonist herself, speaks. And it's the only time she actually has like a character interaction with her voice with another character in that game. That's it. Everything else is like a non-verbal, like, you know, characters are talking to you and then you kind of respond with dialogue options, but it's not voiced or anything. It's just like, okay, yeah, you're just kind of... like the dialogue options are like either getting more info or handing over handing like a quest item to someone, but Wu Chang herself never speaks again with her voice after that initial cutscene. And I thought that was really weird.
I also think that the story, you know, I like, what was it? They tried to make it like as vaguely as possible, like a Souls game, but the problem is it's like at the end of the day, it's like, how do I know I made the right choices or not near the end? It's like, that's like one of the endings is like, I don't even know if I did the right thing at the end because the story is told very vaguely. I know like kind of like a brief idea of what's happening, but when it's told so vague, and then I think we both end up with the bad ending. And then I literally had to Google it up and seeing like, what did we do wrong? You know, it's like, but I just feel it's not told in a good way that you know how to get like the other endings. I feel in Bloodborne, it's like I know I made the right choice or bad choices, and I got the ending that I did based on those choices. But in this game, I don't know how these choices like affected overall. So
yeah,
it definitely
obscures too much because like it's because like you barely have you don't really. You have very thin threads that you're traveling across, and you don't know when. Like, and you can fail some of them for sure, but you don't know when or where or how you failed them along the way. And it's kind of it's, and the game will never, you know, tell you that directly as well. It's kind of more along the lines of the community to kind of figure out together how this thing is built and kind of try to make more of a mechanical sense out of it. So when people revisit the game, maybe they'll have a better idea. There's also like these quiz doors that like that'll give you like two options. Like the one of the very first ones is like you go up to it and like the first option is like the wings of the something, and then the other one is feathered transcendence. And I'm like, I don't know what the fuck this means, man. Like apparently it's a quiz door that like if you chose wrong, I chose wrong, you get teleported to another side of the map. And the other one is like it'll open up for you. And you can get like a benediction out of it. And I don't know if I was able to ever open it up again when I chose wrong, but there's definitely like just some doors that are like quizzes that to my, you know, I don't know like what the, like what's the correct like Chinese translation and phrase to like properly, like it, like the game will not give you info of like,
I heard one of the doors, you literally need to answer it wrong to get the true ending or something. Because you basically... Yeah, I think it's near the end. There's a door that you answer wrong, so it teleports you to this one area. And you get this ring for doing the quests from the elderly guy. And
oh, okay, I did get to that area. I did get to the area, but I did not get that ring of Samsara. And I was like, I don't have this ring. I don't know what the fuck to do. Like, I don't know what to do in this area. So I kind of just teleported back out. So I guess I answered that wrong and I got to that right area, but I never knew how to get that ring of Samsara.
So basically, you need to get the ring from that elderly guy. You get a piece of that ring, and you get the other piece from the guy that brought you to the island. And when you get those two, you get the full ring, and then you go there, and that's how you get the real ending. But you also need to not give the chisel to one of the guys. near the end.
Oh my god.
Those are two conditions to get the real ending. And I'm like, so you had to answer the door wrong? Is that what you're telling me? It's like, but you get a trophy for answering all the doors right. I don't know. It sounds like a
That's crazy. Yeah.
I don't know. It's like, I think those doors are poorly implemented. It's like, you get like a, one of the choices, like, literally, it's like, do you want to defy destiny or face destiny? It's like, how do I know what is the right choice? Right?
Those are synonyms. That's, I guess the idea is if you just, if you, face destiny, you're like accepting it head on. And if you defy, it's like, no, fuck that. I'm assuming that's what it's supposed to mean.
Feels like it could have been a better verb choice.
There's definitely like some awkward like translation choices. Like the spell that I got that I really like, the one that auto dodges. It says that like it gives you like invisibility for it, and it's like no, the enemy can clearly see you when you use it, but it does give you invincibility because it auto dodges for you on that. So
yeah, that's just a mistranslation. Yeah.
So I was like, okay, well, yeah, another thing, like, I guess the last thing, I guess, worth mentioning with this game, and I don't know where you found this out. Personally, for me, I don't care. I think, you know, it's fine, but, you know, the elephant in the room for some people in the game is like, hey, this game has some sexy outfits, some revealing outfits. I personally am like, who cares? It doesn't get in the way of, like, it's pretty solid gameplay. It's cool that it has, like, you know, revealing outfits, and there are a lot of other outfits that look cool as well. And there's a whole transmog system that, you can put on the armor that has like the damage mitigation stats that you like, and then just transmog it with any other piece of armor to get the appearance out of it for those stats. But I think personally, the outfit choices are really cool in this game. They're
awesome. I think they look great.
I like them.
Go for it, Cho.
I was kind of mad that it's like it doesn't let me have any of the costumes. I think they implemented the game wrong. It's like now apparently like there was two patch ago that gave everyone the deluxe edition costumes for free and they took it away.
Oh really?
Yeah, there was a bug which they fixed, I think, in the July 24th or 25th update where people who had the standard edition got the deluxe outfits by mistake. And I think like that's what happened to Chao, because I just had the standard edition and the pre-order bonus before and I bought the deluxe upgrade, so it didn't affect me, but I think it is a problem if people boot up the game and they get a prompt saying DLC has been added or whatever and they equip it and then an update disables that. They should have just let everyone have it, I think. But yeah, that happened with the deluxe edition and standard edition. I think I ended up using, like, pre-release, obviously I was just using whatever was there in the game. But after the deluxe, I used the mix of the deluxe, one of the deluxe costumes and one of the pre-order costumes. But yeah, I think the costumes are fine.
I don't know, Barbie souls or dress-up souls sounds fun to me. Like, yeah, sure, some of them might be more, sure, like, traditional Chinese, and some of them might be more sexy, but whatever, give me a variety, that's fine.
Yeah, I'm cool with it.
As long as you let people do whatever they want with the costumes easily, I think there's no problem.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Overall, I think, very solid game. My full review will be up, you know, very shortly after recording this podcast, probably already up as this podcast is published. But yeah, I'm curious to see where Lianzi goes from here. Hopefully they find enough success with this game. Hopefully, you know, they're in a difficult position because it is their debut game. So optimistic, like, they're not as, you know, well-versed in optimizing their game. But obviously to the public, and it's not the public's fault either. That, like, but the public doesn't care whether it's a game studio's first game or it's their 20th game. If they run into optimization issues, they're gonna, you know, voice their complaints about it. Like I said, no one's really at fault on this one. It's kind of, hopefully they get it sorted out in a timely manner, and they find enough success in this space for them to kind of to tackle another project and see what they want to do from here. Because I think they have a really talented studio, and it really shows in this game. So they did a great job with their first game. Another RPG that came out this week, this one's a re-release, kind of an interesting one. It is Wild Hearts S, exclusive. This version of Wild Hearts is exclusive to the Nintendo Switch 2. James and Mikhail, you guys got a chance to play it. Tell me about Wild Hearts S. I know we talked briefly about it in terms of like the demo capacity and kind of like the not so great performance prospects that the demo showcased, but I assume that you guys played now the full game.
Yeah, I'm about, I think, if I remember correctly, I'm like more than halfway because I've reached the fall region and I did the first hunt there. I want to say that's about halfway through the story. Could be wrong. I do know there was like a high rank thing where like the seasons shift, but I don't remember that being too long for the story aspect and whatnot. I think everything we talked about before kind of still holds true. I would say that in docked mode, when you're playing solo, the frame rate is usually pretty close to 60. So if you're going to be playing it docked and you want to get like a 60 FPS experience, it's not going to be completely locked, but it feels pretty good. Apparently, according to Mikhail, though, that frame rate is highly variable when you're in multiplayer.
Yeah, like I've not been focusing that much on the story because I've been trying to get as much game time multiplayer as possible. So I've been like farming lava back and stuff. And so before we get to that, so you know the demo for Wild Hearts S, it stops you before getting to Minato, which is the main hub village city, not city, hub village area for the game where you upgrade your armor, where you can build your Karakuri to travel like between locations in there. There's like a fisherman's wharf. There are a lot of buildings, like not buildings, but there are like these huts and stuff, loads of NPCs. The first time you get here on Switch 2 runs like absolute dog shit. Like, and I did it handheld, so that was a big mistake. Do not recommend like getting to that handheld. It does not run good. But yeah, like James said, if you're playing docked and you're playing solo, I'd say it's like with caveats for that the performance will be variable. I can at least recommend it, but in multiplayer, it just tanks and the performance is way too variable. This is one of those situations where VRR with low frame rate compensation would have dramatically elevated the experience docked.
The more I play
you can talk. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, the more I played this, and I have played like an equal amount in handheld and docked, but I think handheld is actually fine for the most part, but it needed to have like an optional like 30 FPS cap because it's too variable. And the way I see it, I would be shocked if it's actually changing the resolution when you switch between docked and handheld, because the resolution is super low in docked mode, but the frame rate's so high. Whereas in handheld mode, obviously the resolution isn't native. You can tell it's not native. It still looks fairly good on the handheld screen. Like if it's changing resolution, it's not by much. It's not by a noticeable amount. And I do wonder if that's the case, if the problems in multiplayer aren't necessarily the GPU, but the CPU.
So I think based on the demo, what Digital Foundry said, and like, if I remember correctly, it was something like 648 or 600 and something P handheld, and it was around 900p docked.
But the difference is, I do not think it's 900p docked. That does not seem right.
Yeah, so the thing what they said is, it was Oliver's video from Digital Foundry, and he said that there's the sharpening which he saw in handheld is some of the worst he's seen, and I kind of agree with that, because this is one of those games where you need a slider. You need a slider for this. Like, you can leave it at that default if you want that to be the experience, but this is absolutely one of those games where you need to allow the user to change stuff. But, yeah, so I've been getting some handheld time in, and like, actually been playing multiplayer with four players. I still think the game is fantastic. I still stand by what I said before, where I like, if we're talking about base game, like, obviously Wilds is too soon because we don't have updates to compare it with beyond the first two, but I still think Wild Hearts day one, I had more fun with that than I did with World base game, and like Rise by a massive margin. Like,
Go ahead. Yeah, I've been trying out different weapons this time, because I used the great sword and I forget the exact name of it, but like the pole arm, like sort of like charge blade equivalent.
The umbrella thing. What about the umbrella?
I haven't used the umbrella. I've been using the claw this time, and that is a lot of fun. where it's like the whole thing is you build up your meter, and then once you do it, you can use the claw attack, and it's like, okay, now you're just now it's attack on Titan now, apparently.
Oh yeah, that's the other thing which I feel like I've not seen a lot of people in multiplayer do. Maybe it's the game doesn't tutorialize it well enough, but there's this mechanic where when you see a glowing part where you've probably wounded a kimono monster, you can climb onto its body and then use your hunter arm and just like pull out like a lot of threads for yourself, and you get a temporary buff where you can store like more threads than your capacity is, where you can use that to then build the Karakuri, which is like those, you know, like people called it Fortnite Monster Hunter with its first trailer, because you build walls and you can build like flying around with like these like this helicopter thing and stuff like that. Yeah So I think this is like I'm just enjoying the game a lot now, like I did before, and since people are playing it online. Like, the one thing I will say is, because the PlayStation, Xbox and PC versions have crossplay, I still find people there, because I've been playing it on PS5 to compare, and I still get people almost immediately in hunts, which is like good to see. But I don't know how the population will be on Switch 2 going forward, because it's like, you know, like Puyo Puyo Tetris 2S. It's a siloed thing. Like, there is no crossplay, because this is a different version of the game, and this has 4-player online while the others have 3-player. I don't know what they've done to balance the weapons or anything. Like, I haven't noticed, because I don't really play. Okay. So I'm curious to see how the high rank stuff, when I unlock it, how that goes, because I struggled with that quite a bit on PS5 when I played it originally. So, but yeah, not like, because I've played like, I don't know if it's 300 or 200 and something hours, I'll have to check my save file, but I'm still enjoying the game docked. I feel like this is, like, I've said this before, you've said this before as well, if this game had a 30 FPS cap handheld and a 40 FPS cap optional docked, it would have been like much easier to recommend. But like right now, it's like, yeah, it's just,
yeah, I think at I think at the end of the day, this needed like a month or two extra time for the port, because I feel like if they had gotten DLSS working, they could have like targeted 540p in handheld mode and used DLSS up to 1080p and would probably look the same, but would run better. And if you had it at 720p up to 1440p in dock, it would probably look similar and also run better. I imagine, again, I do think part of it's probably the CPU, in which case you do need those optional FPS caps. Don't make it mandatory. Like, keep it unlocked if like by default. But there was like a, it's, I'd say that the port is acceptable. I think visually there is some muddiness to the visuals, but especially the further on I'm getting, it's like, you know what? This is fine. It's not amazing, but it's fine.
I think that the two more things I want to talk about with this port, one of them is, so right now, Wild Hearts S, like, I don't know if you've played the PC version recently, but I re-downloaded it on ROG Ally and Steam Deck just to see, and I would say that the Switch 2 version is definitely more playable than both of those. Like, the Steam Deck version is dog shit. It's like 19 FPS with worse visuals right now. There's no saving that. The PC port, at least on handhelds, has not changed much. So, like, right now, I say this is the only good portable version, and good is doing quite a bit of heavy lifting over there. So I would say that if someone specifically wants to play these kinds of games only on a portable, yeah, you have your option now. It's not great, but it is more playable than on like the PC handhelds I have, at least. And the second thing is, if you don't play this game and you like good music, the soundtrack is by Masashi Hamauzu. Fantastic soundtrack. Hopefully they release that separately now that Koei Tecmo seems to have like full publishing and control of the game. So that's my hope, at least.
Yeah. I am curious to see if there's going to be if there's any changes to the ending, because I wonder if the reason why they released this is that they do want to give it another shot. I would be perfectly fine with that. I'd actually like that. But I am curious, so I'll keep playing. But I'll probably put up my review in the next like day or so, because I feel like I've gotten far enough in it where it's like, I played the original game. Realistically, the whole reason I wanted to play the sport was to see how it holds up. And I think that's like, even now, the PS5, Xbox, PC versions, they have their technical issues. And I think, considering what this is and what the Switch 2 is, like, I agree with you. I wouldn't say it's a good port, but it's good enough.
Yeah, it's all like, as long as someone goes into this with their expectations in check and they're okay with variable performance, you'll get used to it. At least I got used to it docked, and I'm like, like Wu Chang's stuttering just annoyed me to the point where I just could not play it more on ROG Ally, but I got used to how Wild Hearts S is docked. And I've seen some posts around and some videos shared where people have been saying that if you play the game at 720p docked, it runs at a higher frame rate than if you play at 4K or whatever. I actually just like, I went by eye and I replayed two hunts like side by side and I kept changing the resolution during it. I did not notice a major performance difference. So I would say that if you're playing this game, just run it at whatever resolution you're playing it at. And I would say that if you're... Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I do understand why people would test that because Hitman is actually a game that does change its performance characteristics depending on what resolution you set in the system settings. So
Shadow Labyrinth also does that actually, because when I was playing that and I had my Switch 2 set to 4K, there was constant hitching in like the more open side-scrolling areas. Like it's a side-scrolling Metroidvania game. But in some of the areas where you're not in these small corridor type things, there's constant hitching at 4K. But when I set it to 1440p, that went away. So this is happening in a few games and it's kind of bad because the end user has no way to check this unless they manually adjust this on the system level. Yeah, they should like tell the user.
There should be like a setting in the options for like performance or quality or whatnot if that's going to be a thing. But maybe Nintendo just doesn't let developers change the output resolution on the fly, so that's just speculation, but maybe it's something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, this is something which, unless someone has access to the SDK and dev kit or someone comments on that, we're just going to be speculating on that front. But it is not a good practice, I would say, because like people aren't going to change the system setting output. Like this takes us back to PS4 Pro level. You remember how like Atelier, like some of the Atelier, like what is it? Oh, I don't remember the Atelier or something, but like on PS, that did it on PS5 actually. Yeah, that did on PS5. Yeah,
if you played at 4K, it would be like very variable uncapped refresher. Yeah, yeah, uncapped. Yeah. But if you played at 1080p, then it would be 60 FPS. That was
one of those games. That was the only game which I played on PS5 that had that. But yeah, it's not a good practice. And for Wild Hearts, I'd love it if it gets an expansion or something. I hope it does well, and I hope they keep patching it because I really like the game. But it's like you said, it could have used a month or two more, and it would have been like so much easier to recommend and so much better.
Yeah.
I don't know what they hope the future of the series is going to be. Like I'd be open to another entry in the Wild Hearts series, but they need like some soul searching on like how they want to tackle a new one of these, because I think the foundation is solid and novel, especially like an interesting twist on the Monster Hunter formula. Yeah, as you guys were saying, man, like the looming shadow that every version of this game faces is like those nasty performance optimization issues with it. Other than like the 4-player multiplayer co-op and maybe a rebalancing of it, is there actually like any new substantial like content, like in terms of like new hunts or anything outside of that?
No.
I think they just added the pre-order and DLC content in the base game. So instead of the Karakuri edition, which was, I think the game was $70 and then the deluxe was either $80 or $90 or something. I think right now they just included all the DLC together and it's $50 for the... Oh yeah, and it's a digital release in the US, but UK and Japan get a key card version of it for those who want it on their shelf or whatever. But yeah, that I think it's just they haven't actually... So there's nothing over here for like people who've played it before, except if you want to replay it and you have three other friends who you want to play with. There's
three
nothing
other
over here.
Have a Switch too, and then they all want
to
play.
Yes, three other friends who have a Switch too, and it's a lot of asterisks over there.
I wonder what'll be, besides Mario Kart World, obviously, what'll be like the next like kind of big multiplayer game on the Switch that'll have like a healthy community for, that'll last multiple months.
Well, I'm curious.
Well, it's
I'm
not going to be
something.
WWE for sure, which I'm playing right now because the online is kind of a mess.
Let me check the eShop, see if I can see how this has been selling in Japan at least. Because if there's any one region this is going to do well, it's going to be Japan. Let's see ranking.
It's
possible
it's
that
number
because of...
oh, it's okay. Doing pretty well. It's number 4, right behind Mario Party.
Okay.
The number 1 is Donkey Kong. Number 2 is the upgrade pass for Mario Party. Number 3 is like the bundle with the base game and the upgrade pass, and then the last one, like number four, is Wild Hearts, which is in front of Mario Kart. Yeah. But I feel like most people that have a Switch 2 have already bought Mario Kart right now, so that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Still, that's good. Yeah.
Unrelated to Wild Hearts, I like you brought up Mario Party. I definitely regret buying that upgrade because I bought it assuming it would give me like 1440p in the base game, but it does not. But yeah,
well, that's okay. True. That's a weird thing. But the more I think about it, I kind of understand why they handled it as it did. And I'm sorry, this is completely unrelated to anything we're talking about. Besides Mikhail and I, is anyone else here like familiar with what they did with the Mario Party upgrade for Switch 2?
I played it hands-on the Switch 1 like pre-release at PAX West like last year, very briefly, and that's it.
I played it at the event, and they just added the camera mini games.
Okay.
So the Switch 2 upgrade, the way it works is that when you boot the game, you get three options. You get the original Switch 1 game you can boot up. You get Jamboree TV, which is the Switch 2 edition. I forget what the third one was. There is a third option, but it's not really relevant. I think it's... Oh, no, it's the roller coaster thing, I think. So Jamboree TV is essentially just the Switch 2 edition of this game. It includes the mouse minigames and it includes... Yeah, the camera mini games. I think the camera mini games are actually separate if you want specific camera mini games, but if you have your camera enabled, it will show you while you're doing the regular Mario Party mode. The difference is that there was this island thing where you could have unlocks in the Switch 1 version and some other stuff. Oh, the third thing's game share. Thanks, Mikhail. But all of that, like that island thing where you could unlock stuff and like all of the kind of like set dressing stuff from the original game is not in the Switch 2 edition. Everything, like all the unlocks are just there from default. And when you boot up Jamboree TV, like you can't access any of that stuff. And there's like some new rules, but also there's like one rule set that's gone that's only in the Switch 1 version. I think the main reason they did it the way they did is that since you can buy it as an upgrade to the Switch 1 version, it like overlaps on top of the previously installed version. There's no crossplay between the Switch 2 version of Mario Party Online and the Switch 1 version. So the reason they have that option to boot into the Switch 1 version without any upgrades is for compatibility, which is weird, but it makes sense. And probably the reason they don't have the unlocks for the Switch 2 version is it's like, well, you already have those in the Switch 1 version, so it would be confusing if you unlock something in the Switch 1 version and then you didn't in the Switch 2 version and vice versa, so you're just going to have everything unlocked from the start.
I just think this is a weird precedent to set because, like, you know, Tomodachi Life and, like, those other games which are Switch 1 and probably going to be, like, assuming they get a Switch 2 version. Now you have a situation where Nintendo has a Nintendo Switch 2 edition for a game, but it does not actually have any visual upgrades. And I know, like, people have said it's been on the website. Yeah, so the thing is, like I bought this assuming I'd get the visual upgrade, but I didn't look at the website correctly or clearly enough because there was an asterisk over there which said that the upgraded resolution is just for when you play it using the second thing. So I've seen now people speculate whether Kirby is going to be the same way because the Kirby Deluxe, the DLC is coming out next month. But that we've seen running at 60 FPS or not. I don't know. I just feel like messy for the end user.
Yeah, I think people are making a bit more of a big deal than necessary because you can access all of the actual Mario Party stuff except for Pro Rules, which apparently most people didn't like, and they can fix that with an update and add it back into the Switch 2, like Jamboree TV stuff. Jamboree TV, the actual Mario Party mode, has all of the mini games and has the visual upgrades. It just also has the mouse mini games that are now in the rotation, which, by the way, I played it like a few days ago with some friends. Those mouse mode mini games are really good. But it's confusing, but I think people are making more of a deal about it than it really is. Because when you sit down and actually look at what it does and think about it for a second, it's like, yeah, that's weird, but also to a certain extent, it does make sense what the thought process was. But that's all I had to say about that.
That tangent aside, we can get back to RPGs now.
I think Kirby will be fine, because that's not multiplayer, so there's no reason they would have to segment it. It would just be a flat upgrade. So I don't expect Kirby will have anything like that.
Alrighty. Okay. So we'll see how Kirby shakes out for them. When does the Kirby Switch 2 version of that come out?
End of next month. August 28th, I think, or 29th, or was it 27th? One of those days. It's like end of next month.
It's a really good game. I don't know. I don't know if I'll buy the upgrade thing for it, but I really like that game. Maybe I
pre-ordered it already.
Stuff. Yeah, I pre-ordered the upgrade. It. Yeah.
There's some other a lot of fucking releases at the end of August, so I'm like, I don't know.
There's a Not couple of releases in the next couple of days. Dear Me, I Was, one of the worst titles for a game I've seen, and East 10 Proud Nordics in Japan.
Yeah. Another new title that is not an RPG, but it is from an RPG franchise. There's a new Pokemon Direct that came out, and we'll get into like the some of the info relevant to that a little bit later. But one of the new games that came out of nowhere that Shadow dropped it was a game called Pokemon Friends, and I was like, all right, I'll check it out. Why not? So Pokemon Friends is a game that's out for Switch and mobile devices. It is primarily a like puzzle minigame collection. Where I first downloaded this on mobile devices, it's a free-to-play game. It's kind of a weird thing where after the tutorial stuff on it, you basically have, you can untangle for free once a day on like when I was playing on some mobile device, and when you untangle it, it's like very yarn related, yarn themed, and you have this set of like three puzzle mini games that you can go through, and like there's like a whole bunch of like different puzzle mini games. Like one of the very basic ones is like a Pikachu. You have to connect a line through the light bulbs without interlapping any other lines that you made, and these all have like levels that you progress through. Like there's like a like you'll get this mini game at level one. At first, it's all very simple. Then another day when you untangle, you might get the level two version of this, and you have less time to do this, and they're a little bit more complex. And then another day, you might get the level three version of this. Same thing, a little bit more complex, less time to do them. But they all go by pretty fast. Another mini game is like you're, I think, a Mankey or another one of that evolution line, and you have to get to the goal by punching walls, going up ladders, and then, but you don't want to punch all the walls because some of those walls will serve as bridges, but you go up to a higher elevation to get to the goal, and you have to, and there's some Snorlaxes along the way that kind of block your way towards the goal. There's all sorts of like different puzzle variety in it. Like another one is like a simple counting game of like there's Pikachus and Eevees. You have to put in the numerical value of how many more Pikachus that are there than Eevees on the screen. And once again, it's all time, so you're trying to solve these as fast as possible. And after you're done with these like sets of three puzzle mini games, you're kind of graded on like how fast you did them, and you'll get yarn from them, and you'll get like different elemental yarn. Like you'll get fiery yarn or aqua, watery, wet yarn, or shadow yarn or whatever. So, and you can put this into like a gachapon machine, and these different yarns all correspond to different elemental types of Pokemon on them. So like if you're putting fiery yarn and you're pulling for that, you're only pulling like for fire type Pokemon, and they do have rates, but the only way you get this currency, this yarn, is through playing through the puzzle mini games. You cannot buy them directly with real money and so forth. And when you pull use this yarn on that machine, you'll get a plushie of like different Pokemon. Like you'll get a plushie of Pikachu, you'll get a plushie of Charizard, you'll get a plushie of Zoroara or something, you know. And you can use this plushie either to decorate like, you know, like a room, so you can have like a whole, like you can save up to like different like preset, or you can decorate a room and save that as like as its own room, and then like create another room, and then like a different theme if you want, the different wallpapers, different plushies of Pokemon. And you can also use these Pokemon plushies to kind of turn in for like very, 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 very simple fetch quests for like townspeople to get, and then when you complete their very simple fetch quest, they might give you furniture back to use that furniture to continue decorating your rooms, kind of at your own leisure. But it's a very, very simple, relaxed game that that is focused around, hey, go complete puzzles. When you complete puzzles, you get yarn to use on the machine to get plushies to either decorate or use for fetch quests. If you're just playing this strictly as free-to-play, you do have a limit. You do have, like, stamina, where you can only untangle once a day. But you can get rid of that stamina system and play as much as you want, and that'll cost real money. I think that's, like, I want to say maybe 10 to 15 bucks-ish. And there's also puzzle sets that give you new puzzles added into the rotation of puzzle mini games that you can unlock. And also, when you buy those puzzle sets, there's new Pokemon plushies added into the rotation of those when you pull for plushies in the Gachapon machine. For them, and I think overall, if you want everything, it's like $35. I think, which is like, if you're kind of using that as like as a kind of all-in-one price, and just see that as like, hey, that's the price to unlock the full game. You can play as much as you want without any stamina limits, and it's just like a very, very chillax, you know, puzzle mini game collection that you get, you know, Pokemon plushies out of to decorate stuff. It, you know, it's perfectly fine for what it is. It's very harmless. It's very, you know, admittedly, Adam, you got code for this, and I was like, well, I'm playing Pokemon Friends, so I kind of got that code to get rid of the stamina limit and get those puzzle sets. I've been playing it on my Switch too, but on the mobile device, it has different control options depending on if you're playing it on handheld via mobile or Switch handheld and on a Switch docked. Like, for example, there's this mini game where I think you're, what's the name of the point, like Mudkip, I believe, is like skating on ice, and on handheld controls you like rotate the device, like, you know, tilt it up, tilt it down, but to navigate it across this ice field to kind of get to the goal. But on if you're just playing it on dock, you're just using the control stick to kind of glide across the ice to get there. So there are different differences in the control schemes depending on if you're playing it handheld or docked in that respect. But, you know, there's all sorts of like very, very large variety of Pokemon puzzles in there. They're all fairly straightforward and straight to the point. They take a bit to ramp up in difficulty. But it's just honestly just kind of a nice way to kind of relax on like maybe a stressful day. Just play it for, like, for a few minutes. That's how I've been using it. I've had a busy week, and I was like, you know what? Why not? And I've had, like, you know, a good amount of fun out of it that I'll probably just like return to, you know, here and there. I just I'm in the mood to learn for like some light puzzle solving.
So it's not as stressful as Wuchang?
No, definitely not. I was like, that's. You know, one of the reasons I was like, I need a game to relax to, and that game kind of, you know, serves its role in that. That was nice. But those are the games that we've been playing this week that we can talk about. There are some reviews up on the site. Junior released his review for Mado Monogatari, Fia, and The Wondrous Academy. He gave it a 7. He's like, you know, the dungeon crawling is fairly straightforward, gets old after a while, but there is some nice slapstick comedy to be found here. As far as I know, Junior doesn't have like history with the Mado Monogatari series.
So he likes dungeon crawlers, but he hasn't played this series. He basically said, it's a simple dungeon crawler with simple combat. It kind of grows on you. For the first 10 hours of the game, he thought the characters were insufferable, but like eventually grew on him. And yeah, it's got, he said it's got that sort of like anime flavored slapstick comedy, comedy of errors and dumbassery, I think is his word, throughout like kind of the game. So it's, I guess, that sort of tone, you know, so probably shouldn't go in expecting something super serious or super dramatic.
That's in tune with the character.
Well, he came into it kind of fresh. Like, he knew Dungeon Crawlers, but he didn't know the series, and that was just his takeaway. And he did say it eventually grew on him, and he thought there was enough there that it was, he literally recommended, like, a game you should maybe get on sale. Like, he enjoyed it well enough, but he didn't love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe it's on sale, like, if a PC version comes out and it's relatively cheap, you know, I'll definitely check it out. It's cool that they made a new model Monogatari game.
It's cool that Sega let them actually use the legacy characters. That's right, nice.
The Puyo characters, you know. Because once again, as people may not know, Puyo Puyo is actually a spin-off of the Mono Monogatari series. So it's kind of weird that in many such cases where the spin-off series has outgrown the source material.
Gosh, Persona.
I didn't say it. Let's see. Another thing that Junior put out, he went to Bit Summit 13 and kind of did a roundup of the RPGs that he got to check out there. He got to check out Voidling Bound, a really cool screenshot that he chose for that one. He got to check out Shape Hero Factory. That looks pretty crazy based on the screenshot that he shared. Wretch Divine Ascent.
Is that the one that's like a auto battler type thing?
Yeah, I call it the developers up a Go Pogo called it a backpack battler. Which I guess that's kind of their terminology, but it is an auto battler.
Yeah, so Junior puts it, Wretch is all about customizing your chosen hero class by filling his or her backpack full of stuff.
Okay, actually, I'm familiar with this term, because there was an April Fool's game in Grand Blue Fantasy, where you, like, load up the backpack, and it was based on another indie game, which is the whole Ratsec battle or something like that, where you basically, the game, you all battles, but how you're, like, power is based on what you put in your backpack, and you basically
gameplay is like the preparedness of what you before you set off on your journey, and the journey is like the result of your choices.
Yeah, your character with all battles, but when you like trying to organize your backpack in a way to make the ultimate.
Interesting.
Like,
okay.
It's very much like FF12 or Unicorn Overlord in that sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's basically what the system is. I guess this whole gameplay is probably popular.
Has a cool screenshot that Junior put for the Wretch Divine Ascent. That's neat. The one that really stuck out to me was the next game that he talked about, the Algolimeth. A really cool screenshot. It's like a grayscale dungeon crawlers type of RPG. It looks like almost like a programming aspect to the first person battles.
Yes, and Junior has a history. Like, he's actually, for a long time, he tried to get, like, an Unreal Engine, like, development-type job, so he's messed with Unreal Engine and things like that, and he kind of related this demo that he played with this game to that experience of trying to learn Unreal in terms of, like, a bunch of, like, if-then-else loop statements, that sort of coding language. If you look at the screenshot here, it's a little bit hard to decipher just by looking at it, but there's like a box that says if, and a box that says action, and a box that says target, and there's sort of like these like board nodes, so you're like connecting one node to the other with lines in terms of you're trying to create some sort of, you know, some sort of algorithm or protocol, perhaps relating to the game's name, and that you're creating basically a pattern that gets you through the battles through some sort of like coding logic. Not actually coding, but like kind of emulating that sort of logic. So he actually kind of really took off with this game, and he even said this was his personal pick for best game design at the show. But he has that kind of affinity towards this stuff anyway. But it looks really cool and has a pretty cool idea.
I do like that concept whenever people try to like integrate into their core game of like trying to maybe teach like what programming looks like on a very, very surface level to people of like, hey, you know, there's a lot of things going on in the math of the getting a game to work. Like I remember Game Dev Garage by Nintendo. I forgot the exact name of the game, but they had a similar concept in that their official.
Yeah, that's the name. They even gave it an update for Switch 2 for mouse controls.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. And then another game that we're more aware of that he checked out at the show was Sacrifier, that HD 2D-esque RPG that's got multiple delays at this point. I think it's scheduled for next year, I think. Next year after they got feedback from their recent demo. So, yeah, got to check out quite a bit there for us. Seems like Bit Summit was a great time. I know a friend of the show, Sal Romano, who runs Gamatsu, also went to Bit Summit on his trip to Japan. Seems to have had a great time as well.
I think he has got a few interviews yet to come, and I don't know if he's going to do a published interview or not, but James, you interviewed the Rattatan people, right?
Yeah, I talked with him.
Yeah, he had some sort of Rattatan event also, or preview, or demo or appointment also at Bit Summit, so he's out too.
Cool. Yeah. So that's I definitely do want to go to a Bit Summit one of these days. It seems like a great event. Always like some of the most creative stuff you'll just kind of find there at those smaller indie events.
Yeah, if you ever get a chance to do TGS, the indie section at TGS is also really, really nice. There's like so many different developers from literally all over the world, and like a lot of those like Asian devs that like not just Japanese but like Chinese and Korean that you just won't see outside of China and Korea unless they're a bigger game like Phantom Blade Zero or Wuchang and stuff like that. So
they're just like really, really nice people as well. They just want as many people as possible to like know that their game exists and check out like what they're cooking up. You know, they're always very welcoming from what I hear of like, hey, you know,
they are. Yeah,
cool.
Like a lot of like I've said in the past, TGS really does. And I'm sure BitSum is the same way. It's like there's so many devs that want people around the world to see their games that don't necessarily know the best way to vouch that, like how to go about it. So like when you go to events like that, it's like they're over the moon because it's like, oh, somebody checking our games. It's not in our home country. It's always a warm feeling.
Yeah, like here over in the West, like you get some bits of that, like with more official publishers like Playism that do, you know, consistently publish like smaller indie projects, and they go to attend events like PAX West for people to check it out. So, but they you know, it's not directly with the developers most of the time, which is, you know, sometimes very valuable in that aspect to see those developers face to face. James, you put up a pretty crazy awesome interview with Falcom president Toshihiro Kondo here. And this was a very comprehensive piece. I'll let you speak for what the premise is and what you want to talk about it. With the headline, "As the Trails series is ending, is now in sight, Nihon Falcom prepares to tackle the impossible."
Yeah, so before I talk about my interview, I do want to shout out both the Nintendo Life and Hardcore Gamer interviews as well. Like, overall, like, there was obviously a number of interviews that Nisa, like, facilitated between Kondo and the Western press, and every one of those interviews, myself included, obviously, but every one of those interviews is excellent. You should read them.
Yeah.
Like, Nisa and Alan over there, who's their interpreter, like one of the main guys over there, should be very proud at what they managed to do with that. Like, genuinely, all of them, incredible. As for mine, I do know some of the other interviews that ask him kind of like a follow-up to that one question I had about like the inspirations behind Calvert and its setting last year. But this time around, I had a pretty different tact. Because especially after finishing Trails Beyond the Horizon's Japanese release, without going into spoilers, pretty much anyone that's familiar with how that game concludes can tell you that while we're not at the ending, it sets up things where you can see what direction the series is heading for the ending. And Falcom themselves isn't even shying away from that. And basically this whole interview, it kind of started off talking about like the challenges of like, how do you juggle all of these different characters, all of these different regions when you're developing these games now with a series that's like 13 games long? Obviously, they haven't announced it yet, but there's going to be at least a 14th game. And Kondo himself says that he foresees that he doesn't know how many games exactly there's going to be by the time things are said and done. But he said he threw out a number saying even if it ends up being 20 games. And it was really fascinating hearing from him, like him, like specifically talk about the internal structure of Falcom and how Trails as a series really is the glue that holds everything together and how every decision has to take into account Trails. Like, and even down to the fact that it's like, okay, we're not at the end of Trails yet, but as a company, Falcom has to consider, okay, we are close enough to that reality where Trails is going to be over. We need to start building up other IPs besides East so that when Trails is done, we have those IPs to fall back on. And because of that, it's a juggling act between, okay, maybe some people on the team are feeling burnt out from Trails. What can we do to make sure that they're creative, like that they don't get fully burnt out and that creatively they're in a good spot, mentally they're in a good spot, so that they don't want to leave the company and they feel happy and engaged with their work. Sometimes that means putting them on another project like East or Tokyo Xanadu or any of these other like IPs that Kondo has talked about in the last couple of interviews but hasn't revealed anything yet. But we know that there's at least a couple of new IPs or returning IPs that they are currently working on. And so those are, in some of those cases, if people are feeling burnt out from Trails, have them work on that for a while. But that sometimes he can't accommodate all of that. So in other cases, it's like, okay, work on a mini game. Or if you're a writer, work on like a novel in the game and stuff like that. And it's like really fascinating just seeing him talk about all of this stuff. And it really, the one takeaway I got from this discussion is, at least from what he said, it seems like Kondo has a very good grasp about what's important in regards to his team's like mental state when developing these games. It seems like he at least understands that he has to pay attention to that, and that it's like critical, especially as they reach the end game here. And it's fascinating also hearing him just directly say that, yeah, so we're slowing down from here on out, which kind of I expected that considering like this year's release is a Trails in Sky remake. I kind of assumed from going forward, they were going to kind of do a TikTok pattern where it's like, here's a mainline Trails game, here's a remake. Here's a mainline Trails game, here's a remake. And hearing him directly say that, not saying directly that there's going to be that specific pattern, but they're slowing down because they want to make sure that they stick the landing on the ending. Just really interesting stuff. And then, yeah, I'm really happy with how this interview turned out.
Yeah, it was really excellent. You and the other outlets had like really, really important talks to Kondo, and it really paid off for all of you. Like, I'm very proud this, you know, for you and all the others, how well this turned out. I think it's really interesting seeing Kondo also. I guess this, like, as a byproduct too, I wonder if this opens up like, hey, because they're slowing down on this to make sure that, you know, the quality is like consistently like excellent on the way out and make sure they really stick the landing and the payoff of like the conclusion, the finality of the entire Trails project, like almost like what, two decades in now.
Or two decades like, in.
Are we two decades in or almost
2004,
two decades in?
Right? Already,
2004, yeah, last year when
last year the two decades. Yeah.
Yeah, last year at TGS, when I exchanged business cards again, they had new business cards for the 20th anniversary, yes, right. With, like, the logo and whatnot.
Yeah, but it's just interesting because as a potential byproduct of slowing down, that makes like the prospect of worldwide simultaneous more feasible too.
Yeah. Especially since they'll have caught up by like, and off. well, I can just say that the translation for Beyond the Horizon, like the base translation, maybe not the editing and the voice acting, the base translation, that's done. So theoretically, they could start the translation for the next game as soon as Falcom gave them the script. So if it's not coming out until, I assume, last week of September next year, then they can just, like, if they get the script, like, within, like, a month, like, a couple of months, theoretically, it could be a day-and-date release for the next Trails game. Yeah. And that's insane.
And not to bury the lead, because, along with your article, they also, when the embargo lifted, they announced the official release date for Trails Beyond the Horizon is January 15th, 2026. So they announced at an earlier, like several weeks ago, they had to delay it back out of 2025. But it's a fairly small delay. It's still coming out at like almost at the beginning of next year. So they are on it.
Someone will be reviewing it in December or whatever, playing the review code.
It does, yeah. Godspeed to them. It is a mega game. It is chunky. But yeah, so it's really cool. Like, you see also small insights up here, like one of the junior members handling different quest lines and stories in East 10, and one of like the most beloved ones in East 10 apparently is that was written by Kondo's secretary, and like, hey, yeah, you want to try this out? And that's really cool.
I'm gonna just guess, is that the blind woman one?
It's the one with the fruit.
Oh, okay, yeah. I was actually, when playing the game, I was actually kind of surprised, like, this is a side quest? It was very involved for a side quest.
Yeah.
That's, but it's like, I'm always impressed, I guess, with Falcom's way of adapting to the times and being able to be flexible enough to meet the demand of just the changing circumstances of game development and the industry in general, because Falcom, whether you know it or not, they've been around for freaking ever. Falcom has endured through thick and thin since the early days of the game industry.
Yeah. So. And I do want to stress that, like, reading through my interview, like, the whole like thing that he kept going back to is how important like Falcom's workforce is and like the communal aspect of that company. And it was really neat just hearing and like talk about that, like even down to like the way that customs kind of just like trickle down, like the books, like in Trails, and how like characters in those books end up being characters in the main games. That was an inspiration from the Gagarv trilogy and just became a custom in the company over the last like 30 years, which is really cool.
Ando wanted to remind people that he's a real one. He's like, yeah, I'm a Gagarv trilogy stan, you know, I'd love Gagarv. I came in because of Gagarv. Like, all right, Kondo, flex on everyone. It's interesting that and you said it in your article too, that he states bluntly that if we ruin the ending of Trails, that it may as well become the worst series in the world. There's no coming back from that. You know, they know they want to meet the demands and expectations of people who spent literally years of their lives. Many, many hours of their lives going on this journey and believing in them at every step of the way, through thick and thin. So, phenomenal work from you, James, and through the other outlets who were able to get the opportunity to interview Kondo. It is almost like Falcom's like almost reaching this event horizon for them of like, what does this company look like in once Trails is done, you know? Yeah.
And I am very curious about like what announcements are going to have in December, because it's clear that they've got to announce like, okay, what new IPs are they making or what are they like returning to? Because it's not just Tokyo Xanadu. It's also at least one other thing, probably more than one other thing. And I'm very, very curious about what that means for the company's future.
It's time for Dinosaur.
Bring, oh yeah, hell yeah. Bring me that dungeon RPG goodness. Also, where's a Brandish 2 remake, damn it?
Yeah, where's Brandish? So yeah, I'm interested. I'm very interested. You know, Falcom, you know, it's kind of weird to say, but like they're almost at that point where like they're becoming unexpected once again. So that's cool. That's really cool. And then to round out the article shout outs here, Mikhail, you did you got to check out both the Saga games and the East games running on the Switch 2. I'll let you take the wheel here on what you want to talk about with these.
Yeah, sure. So I was actually planning on doing the Saga one before we recorded the last episode, but it just ended up being more work than I expected, which usually happens with these articles because too many Saga games, and I forgot I hadn't played one of them before, probably a week before that. So I had to like just do some last minute testing in addition to that with collection of Saga, because I had that on Steam, not on Switch, so I just picked it up for that. So let's do it one by one. So the Saga games, all, I think except for Emerald Beyond, all of them have been remakes or ports to the Switch from some form. Like, it started with Romancing Saga 2, which was a pretty mediocre port. Then there was Romancing Saga 3, which was a little better. Then there's Saga Scarlet Grace Ambitions, which is a fantastic game, but it was not great on Switch. Stuff like that. Then Romancing Saga 2, Revenge of the Seven, like, fantastic remake, but few issues on Switch and stuff like that. Emerald Beyond, which is the most recent new game, is actually worse played on Switch. So every Saga game, which most of them have physical releases only on Switch, as you can see in my photo, because I imported all of them from Asia, they all have some issues or the other where it got to a point where I used to tell people to play it on another platform if they had the, like, if they could, and avoid the Switch version. But on Switch 2, you can brute force a lot of these issues. So you have like Saga Scarlet Grace Ambitions finally at 60 FPS without drops, because it was not great on Switch 1. Stuff like that. So going through each of the games, and with all these articles which I do, I also put in a few things what I'd like to see in potential upgrades or updates if they ever get some. Obviously, these games are too old in many cases to get any updates, but it's wishful thinking in a way. So with Saga, a lot of the games had load time improvements. All of them which had performance issues, the performance got smoothened out and stuff like that. So if anyone plays on Switch or like dropped some of the games before and still owns them, you can experience them with some improvements with Saga at least. There are like the Romancing Saga 2 release, you know, the original, not the remake. That game feels awful to play still with its input lag and stuff. So I would just tell people to play the remake, like don't even bother with the original. And Revenge of the Seven, like, you know, revisiting all these games, it just got me, like, if we had infinite time, I'd just replay like five Saga games one by one, but that is not happening. So that Saga, like, I covered every single game, including collection of Saga, Final Fantasy Legend. Did you do Minstrel Song? Which, yes, I did that. That input lag is a bit less. It just generally feels better to play on Switch 2 than it does on Switch 1. And I did every single Saga game. And moving on to the Ease franchise, before I published, I was actually chatting with a friend of mine, and he said, what's your next Switch back compat article? And I said Ease, and he said, did you get the Egg console release? And I was like, oh no, I forgot about those. But yeah, for the Ease thing, I did Ease 8, Lacrimosa of Dana. I did Ease 9, Monstrum Nox. Ease 10, Ease Origin. Ease the Oath in Felghana, the memoir release. And I actually bought Ease Memories of Celceta from the Japanese eShop just so I could be as thorough as possible, but didn't end up covering the Egg console releases. So with Ease, it's a similar thing. You had a lot of late ports, some not so great ports, some decent ones. So I'll go step by step quickly. Ease 8, Lacrimosa of Dana, pretty bad on Switch, just about acceptable, lots of visual issues. On Switch 2, still has the visual issues. Performance is 30 FPS, but fine, and it loads faster. Ease 9, no saving that Switch port, no saving the PS4 version also, unless you play on PS5. And I would honestly just avoid Ease 9 on Switch. Like, when I interviewed PH3's Durante for Trails Through Daybreak 2, I actually asked him what he thought of the Switch 2 reveal and whether he'd do a port of Ease 8 and 9 for Switch 2, because I feel like they'd benefit a lot. And he obviously said that this decision is up to the publisher, but he would love to deliver the, like, a version of Ease 8 on portable consoles, which is good because that doesn't exist right now. Because, like, as much as I think both James and I love the Vita original, super ambitious game, very good for Vita hardware, that's missing content, and it's not 60 FPS, and it has like a lot of cutback visuals compared to what other systems can do. So, yeah, like, it's unfortunate where Ys 8 and 9 are on Switch, but that's where we are. Ys 10, I would just say don't play it. Wait for potential localization of Proud Nordics, assuming that's good on Switch too. Ys Origin is a funny thing because I feel like they baked in this mega long loading in the beginning where it tells you, like, you know, the splash screens and stuff, because it takes longer to load than every single Ys game on Switch and Switch 2 combined for some reason. So I think that was just a bizarre thing from .emu. Ys Othin Felghana is the most interesting of the lot because that game actually rendered at 1080p even on Nintendo Switch 1 and was downsampling, kind of like Hyrule Warriors Definitive Edition. So because of this, if you play that game on Switch 2, you get a native 1080p experience, making it a fantastic portable way to play it, like straight up. Like, I would say if someone didn't play that on Switch, just buy it on Switch 2 now. Like, no patch needed. It just runs at 1080p and it looks really good. Although the one caveat there is Falcom based the Memoir release on the PSP original and used some weird upscaling for the textures, so there's some tiling issues. But otherwise, it's just, like, fantastic, and Felghana is, like, one of Falcom's best
PSP
games.
Original? It was PC original, and then PC.
Yeah, sorry, the game itself is a PC original, but for the Memoir release, they based it on the PSP version, not the PC version.
Yeah, I remember that was sort of weird with the... I remember that was sort of weird with the Xseed PC port for a while. And then I think Xseed eventually, like, kind of combined versions on the PC port, so it's got, like...
Yeah.
The PSP voices, but the PC, like, UI or whatever, but Xseed does
that. So, and Xseed's PC port actually has, like, very good textures and high resolution support and stuff, but the Memoir release on PS5, PS4, and Switch, they use the PSP version as a base, so the UI is kind of big. And while that is fine for playing on a handheld like the Switch, it looks really bad when you play Doctor on TV. And they did some weird upscaling as well, so it's kind of unfortunate because there's no definitive portable version, I'd say, unless you, like, deal with the PC version's launcher and stuff. And the PC version apparently still has some issues where if you play it above 60 FPS, the game has some, like, some stats or something changes as far as I remember. But yeah, that's a little unfortunate. But yeah, it's 1080p handheld. And Celceta is bizarre, like... The game on Switch 1 does not actually run at 60 FPS. It's like an uncapped frame rate with it drops here and there, and it's not even 720p native. It looked like it's... Like, I kind of expected better for a Vita game ported to Switch, but it just feels weird and looks blurry. But when you play it on Switch 2, it's 60 FPS. So I guess whenever potentially Xseed, if they localize it, it'll be good to play on Switch 2 if you missed out on Celceta. It's not my favorite Ys game, but that's the reason I'm a Falcom fan. Like, that was the first game I discovered by them. So, yeah, that's the Ys series. If I potentially visit this when more ports or when more releases happen, I will probably pick up the Egg console games just to have the most complete article out there. So, yeah, that's two. I don't know what I'll end up doing for next week. There's, like, too many franchises which are currently in the works. But I am working on Final Fantasy. There are too many games, but I will get to it. So, yeah.
The Eternal Project.
The Eternal Project is Atelier. Yeah. Like, can you just imagine? Jeez. But yeah.
How many Atelier games are there? Like, 15?
I think there are more than that.
I think on Switch or something like that. Because you have the Arlen Trilogy in the fourth game. You have the Dusk Trilogy. You have the... Mysterious Trilogy in the fourth game, and then you have the Rise of Trilogy, and then Yumiya.
There's a few spin-offs. And then
you have Nelke. As well.
Was Nelke on Switch, or did that come out
before?
And it
runs like dog shit. It is on Switch, and it runs like dog shit. It's the worst Atelier. On Switch.
I want to say that's the only Atelier game that released, in the West at least, on both Vita and Switch, I think.
I don't remember if that was on Vita, because I thought I own every Atelier localized game on every platform. I'll have to check if I own that or not. But yeah, I played that on Switch, PS4, and PC, and I think even the PS4 versions capped at 30 FPS. It was just a bizarre... Feels like a game they made for mobile with this structure, but then they had to rejig into this premium thing, and it has like a shitload of DLC also. But yeah, like, it's... There are too many Atelier games, and there are like... 4 more coming this year just to Switch, because you have the the Ryza Trilogy DX versions, and then you have Resleriana, which is getting the new one, which is coming in September. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, lots of stuff. I was working on that stuff slowly, but yeah, hoping to have something good. But yeah, very happy to have done the E's. I wanted to get the E stuff out before Proud Nordics comes out, because otherwise, yeah, that would be a little outdated. So, yeah.
It's okay. In a few years, you'll have another one to test that, because apparently, in an interview with Famitsu this week, Falcom shared that they are starting development on the next East game. Not officially announced, but they are starting development.
This probably won't happen, but I still hope somehow someone convinces Kondo, just give Ease 9 the expanded release it deserves. Come on.
Yeah, I'm bracing that Proud Nordics is going to make Ease 10 my second favorite East game behind Ease 8. And it's like, man, Ease 9 really needed something like that.
I am interested to play the full version of 10 with Proud Nordics, because I never played the base version.
Yeah. The thing that gets me about 9 is that, like, back then, and this was, like, right before the PS5 came out, they had ideas for what an expanded East 9 might have been. Like, they had, like, genuine ideas, so it's like, I don't know why they just decided to never do it. I don't know.
I think
maybe that's one of the things that they're gonna do to kind of pump the release calendar full so they have more time for trails. Maybe they'll go back and do that with Ease 9. That'd be nice.
He's Memoir Monstrum Box for Switch 2.
That's cope, but damn it. Maybe.
I think they're probably stuck in development hell.
We both just send a check to Kondo, like, from James and myself. What do we need to make this happen?
Next time I interview him, it's like, hey, so you've done Ease 8 and Ease 10 have gotten expanded versions. When are we going to get one for Ease 9 where with the ideas that you talked about 5 years ago?
All right. Moving on to news. We have a good amount of news articles this week. The first thing that we have on the docket here, Bandai Namco has announced at long last, Elden Ring Nightreign players, your duo expeditions are coming on July 30th in patch 1.02, so they are now officially supporting a two-player mode with Elden Ring Nightreign. You no longer have to, you know, party up with a friend and then, like, a pub person that's ruining your run. You can just have the two of you go at it. And along with this, they're adding some new quality of life UI improvements, like more filtering options for relics, for all the crazy amount of relics that you have. And you're probably getting frustrated that there's not enough filtering options to find the one that you want. So, finally, good on them. I've been better late than never. I still probably should have launched for the duo expeditions, but you know, it's here. It's going to be here very soon. On that front, they also announced some new sales milestones for the Elden Ring. Elden Ring series at this point. They announced that the Elden Ring Shadow of the Erdtree, the DLC expansion, sold surpassed 10 million units, and Nightreign has surpassed 5 million units. So the Elden Ring franchise is doing quite well on the sales front, as the projects have been selling millions and millions and millions. Extremely, extremely doing well for both From Software and Bandai Namco.
And we don't know when the Switch 2 edition's coming, right?
Correct. Didn't announce anything new about that. So, but it is coming to Switch 2 eventually. I'm sure. I'm interested to see how many millions it'll sell on there as well. Because the Switch 2 edition will be the base version of Elden Ring plus the Shadow of the Erdtree DLC expansion on it. So, Switch 2 players will have a boatload of hours. A lot of hours getting out of that Switch 2 version package. As you mentioned earlier, the Pokemon Direct shared off a new trailer for Pokemon Legends ZA and announced a Nintendo Switch 2 bundle is coming out when it releases on October 16th. In the new trailer, they showed off a Mega Dragonite. I don't know how I feel about the Mega
Dragonite
design.
I've seen mixed response on this thing.
I think it's cute, but also it's kind of like a little off. It's kind of dorky, I guess, in a charming way. I think I'm like, I flip-flop between it's like, that's great, and I'm like, it's almost there. But what have you seen, Adam, on your end on this?
I've seen some people say Mega Evolutions were a mistake because of this.
How do we feel about Mega Dragonite in here? Does anyone have any strong feelings of Mega Dragonite here? James, what do you think?
I think it's really, really good, and people are maybe a bit cowards for not liking the head wings. It's like the one thing that I remember people complaining about back, like since Pokemon started, is like, why does Dragonite look nothing like Dratini and Dragonair? And it's like, this is the missing link, and it looks awesome. Come on.
I agree that like maybe the wings just need to be on the maybe slightly more to the back. Maybe
I'm sorry, but it's like. People are saying, why doesn't it look more like Dragonite? Dragonite is a goofy-ass motherfucker, and having head wings is perfectly on brand.
That's true, too. You're not wrong. That they showed a lot of Switch 2, the Switch 2 version in the footage here, so it's kind of
it's a
pretty, really smooth frame rate on that. Showed more about, you know, the flow of the game. You have Rogue Mega Evolutions happening in the city. That you team up with another teammate on. You team up with this team called Team MZ. You're basically like climbing up this like battle royale ladder going from rank Z to rank A.
Yeah, I know I'm not the only one, but I didn't realize like, oh, that's why the title is that.
Yeah, me too. Okay, got it.
You start
that makes
Z,
sense.
You go to A. Yeah.
That's right. So, yeah, I mean, this looks like a really, really fantastic game that I want to check out. But it's going to be weird, but playing this game right after playing Digimon Storytime Stranger. Fuck. Back to back, huh? So, but did you see anything else, James, Mikhail, that's worth mentioning here in the ZA trailer that I'm missing?
Hopefully they have as many customization options for dudes as the ladies, because that was definitely a problem the original X and Y had, and I think that it might just be a situation where I'm sure they're going to let you use the customization options regardless, because it's going to be like no specific gender thing as they've done in the past couple of games. But still, I hope that there's adequate enough masculine leaning fashion options, because that was like the one. What they've shown looks really nice. Just hopefully there's enough for everyone there. But yeah, I'm really excited for this. I have been consistent in saying that like Legends Arceus was one of my favorite, probably my favorite like mainline Pokemon game, because it felt like it wasn't restricting itself. And it's very promising between this and Pokemon Champions that it feels like both Pokemon Company and Game Freak are deliberately trying to be like, okay, people love competitive Pokemon. We need to make it easier for people to get into that. But also, competitive Pokemon has always been kind of a shackle for the mainline games and kind of prevented what they could do. You could not do something like Legends EA with an ATB style like movement and an actual like positioning style battle system if you had to adhere to the competitive Pokemon format, because people would absolutely tear it to shreds, because people have been doing competitive Pokemon for decades. People love it, especially nowadays. But now that there's a dedicated version for that, maybe we'll see more mainline Pokemon games try stuff like this.
I do like the new key artwork, the day and night key artwork that they released for this one, along with the two trainers contrasting each other, because I see a lot of Pokemon I recognize, like, oh, there's a Chikorita and a Pidgeotto and a Turtledove and a Staryu or Starmie and an Arbok. Yeah. I know those.
Yeah, there's like an 8K version of that key art on the press site that I downloaded and I immediately made my wallpaper on my desktop.
Yeah, it's a really, really good key art for that. So yeah, it's going to be still coming out October 16th, 2025. No changes there. So that is still coming, just in a few months. Moving on, we have news on Assassin's Creed Shadows. It'll be getting a new game plus mode on July 29th. And the Claws of Awaji expansion is coming out September 16th. Is the Claws of Awaji expansion the one that they said that they were going to offer to players for free on that? Or is this a new one that they announced? I don't know if there's a paid
DLC. I don't remember that they said they'd announce they'd offer anything for free other than like the normal
update. It was free if you pre-ordered the game, I believe.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah.
And then they also noted that this new Claws of Awaji expansion unlocks only after completing the main story of the main game. So if you want to be, ready for that, complete the game finally. Stop looking at your 80 plus hour save. I'm like, should I beat this game finally? They have new quality of life updates coming. Some of it include like hideout updates and upgrades, uncapped frame rate for cutscenes on but that's only a PC only feature. So uncapped frame rate for cutscenes, but only on the PC version. World map unfogging after completing viewpoint synchronization per region, as it says in the bullet point. That's a lot of terminology. And the a big one here is ability to skip time of day, jumping between dusk and dawn as well. And a new forge upgrade level to reach higher rarity. So that's all great. They're continuing to support the game and so forth. We also have Chao, you're gonna have to handhold me to this one. There's a substantial update coming to the Sword of Convalaria mobile and PC game. They're basically reaching their first anniversary, and of course with any when any of these live service games reach their first anniversary, they have a lot of updates coming to it, a lot of goodies. You seem to be quite excited for the first anniversary of this game. Tell us about it.
So basically in the first anniversary, obviously you get a lot of free stuff. Obviously that's like in any anniversary for a game, right? Except for the whole universe game, you get jack shit for anniversary for those games. But so there's also major story expansions coming out. In the last recent, like, if you've been keeping up with the game, one of the characters you use is Princess Iana, and there's a story arc where she basically, instead of, like, being, like, a sort of, like, almost like a damsel in distress in a way, she's constantly being, I don't know, I wouldn't say captured, but she's being literally used like, as a political tool to use for their own gains, and in this story arc, she basically said, screw that, I'm gonna kill all you guys, grab her sword, and just becomes a fighter, and trying to, like, lead, like, her people into, you know, battling all the oppression from the other sides, right? So, you get, like, expansion to that, and if you ever play the story, they kind of end in, like, a cliffhanger if you played one of the new story arcs. And I guess it's kind of expanding on that, so you get stuff for that as well.
And this new story coming to the game, that's the single player branching path story part that pretty much can be completed for free without like engaging with any of the gacha mechanics, right?
Yeah, but they added like this one extra route, because all like the other routes kind of lead to like sort of like a bittersweet ending where like most of your character dies at the end, and with like few surviving things. So this new branch, when you help like the element tribe of people, which basically these merchants that treat people like objects, it's like if you join that side, it's like obviously you don't join them, but you're kind of like being neutral, and then that side kind of like everyone lives, but it has like a sequel bait ending. It's like, and then I'm guessing this expansion is kind of like a lead up to what that expansion is going to. So that's what I'm kind of guessing from
here. How often does this game get, like, story expansions?
There's been two story expansions. Okay. One is a prequel. I forgot what the name of the prequel is called. I think it's, like, Crimson Knight, I think it was. I think we have a news post about that once when they had that. That was a prequel story. It's an extremely dark prequel story. Like, it's very dark. But it's basically like a prequel story about Revaya. She's like the character that saves you at the beginning in the prologue. Mm-hmm. And if you ever notice her character design, she's missing an arm. Like her second arm is like a It's made out of wood. Have you ever seen that? And that entire prologue is kind of like explaining that she used to be like really good friends with this commander girl, which is Sophia. Like, you don't know what their relationship is if you play it for the base game. You just see, like, they know each other, but they don't seem to be friends, right? And you play that expansion, it goes back to their Canopy days. They're, like, the best friends, and they're, like, almost even lovers, right? And basically the entire thing went sour, like, all prequel story, you know, kind of goes in, right? Because, you know, it's like, how does the best friend become bitter enemies, right? And this prequel kind of explains it, right?
And then there's another story expansion before this upcoming one.
And that other one was the one with the merchant arc, which is the element arc that I was talking about, where you know, team up with this merchant. You know, that was actually a very good story. I actually do enjoy it. And I actually got the best ending on my first try, which I think was kind of awesome. Like, you don't know if you get the best ending or not. And this game doesn't let you, like, freely choose, because once you like play a game, you're basically committed, right? You don't have like a safe state to go back.
You can't rewind until like you're done with that entire playthrough.
Yeah, no. I heard they added like some options to make it a lot easier to get the endings, but it's still quite a long runtime to get the endings. But
I have a question for you. What does your playtime look like now? What's your like your playtime hours on this game? Do you play primarily on Steam?
A bit of both, but according to my Steam, let's see, I'm just gonna.
Like, I'm curious.
It is 276 hours on Steam.
But that's not the full picture. It's like that's only what you played on Steam and not elsewhere. Linked up
yeah, to data. I had to play it on mobile too because, you know, I had to work a lot.
Yeah.
Does not include my work time, so.
Alrighty. Oh, yeah. You know, just an easy 300 hours spent on that game. It seems like you like it.
Yeah.
It's cool.
I like it. It's just like, I don't like doing the events in this game. I think the events are like the things I don't like to do because you're basically stuck on these missions and you basically need a galaxy brain to solve it or how they intended to solve it, which I don't really like. There's like no flexibility on like the maps, right? If you get what I'm saying. It has to be like done in their order. If in solve it, right?
I also heard that this game, I guess the global version, and it already happened in China, but there was a collaboration with Delicious and Dungeon as well. And that's
apparently in this, they're telling you that they will give out like the first unit for free from the collab or something. So that's good. I heard there's like free collab units, right? So
okay, cool.
I watched like the first couple episodes of anime, so I'm kind of familiar with it, but not the biggest expert of it.
Yeah, I mean, you don't really have to. It's like it's kind of like a episodic type of show. It's not like super super narrative focused, but it's a good type to watch an episode here and there. It's a fun show.
And I believe there's a second season coming or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like so a lot of stuff. So if you've been tuning out of the game, it's like, well, just come back for the anniversary, get all the free stuff, you know, I don't know. I think you need to be careful. Like, this is the first game you had to be careful with the free rolls, if you get what I'm saying. Like, most games, like, you get the free rolls, you just roll and hope that you get something good. But this game, if you're, like, a veteran, you need to be careful with free rolls, because you could kind of manipulate pity in this game in a way.
Okay.
Yeah, because you have, what is it, there's a pity for having your luck being shitty at below 2%. There's a pity for getting the desired banner unit from going 180. And there is also, a pity for, going SSR for just doing 90 rolls. There's a lot of pity in here, and just getting free stuff.
I remember I researched that stuff, and I was like, okay, sure.
Yeah, they really make it confusing. I think one of the drawbacks in this game is that there is no, like, the 50-50, even you lost the 50-50, getting your next unit does not guarantee the 50-50. So that is the game that kind of sours me a bit about this game.
But as you said about this game, that's oddly enough, that's kind of optional if you're just in there solely for the story mode, like the single player story. Segment is completely separate from all of that stuff.
Yeah, it's like, stay for the single player, but got into the gacha because you just want to support the game, I guess. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, maybe they make a single player game one day. I'll tell you, it'll be good. There is a single player content one day.
All right. Well, that's sort of Convalaria and their upcoming expansion for this world of peace. Moving on, Atalia Yumiya, speaking of collabs, got its own collab this week. It collaborated with Tekken, got a Tekken series collaboration pack alongside a new update. There's free DLC. It added some Tekken series collaboration quests. You got some Reyna from Tekken 8 outfits for Yumiya. And so if you want to dress up Yumiya like Reyna from Tekken 8, it's there. My personal favorite thing out of this is the Heihachi wig for Yumiya. So if you like Heihachi's awesome hairstyle of like primarily bald but has like those side spiky hairs on the side, you can give that to Yumiya if you want with that accessory.
Tell me when they give me a Lars haircut instead.
and two Tekken series collaboration maximized mana surges for Yumiya. So it's kind of interesting that they have like Tekken series collab quests that they implemented in the game. So it's not just cosmetic. There's actually gameplay stuff as well, and there's moves as well too.
This is like the opposite of what Tekken got, because they just added one T-shirt and that ahoge hair as an option. That's all.
Yeah.
So like people were joking about how the Tekken DLC in Yumiya is like a full course meal, and the Yumiya DLC in Tekken is like just getting the bill with nothing. So I just saw a lot of people annoyed with that because they did that before. So everyone thought, is this just going to be like a bad collab for both games? But no, they actually put in a lot of effort for free DLC for Yumiya.
It's really funny how like Yumiya is having all these collaborations with random Bandai Namco IPs for some reason, and they're putting so much effort into it, and like on Bandai Namco's end, it's like, yeah, this is good.
Yeah, because they had a recent one also with Tales of Graces F.
Yep. Really good outfit, by the way. Really good outfit.
Yeah. So, Atelier Yumiya continues to get support with like interesting collabs from other Bandai Namco IPs. I wonder what else they're going to...
I really hope they make a native Switch 2 version of this. I'm not holding my breath. It probably won't happen until 5 years from now when they do a DX remake or remaster of the eventual Yumiya trilogy.
We also have another news update for the upcoming Trails in Sky first chapter remake. They introduced the city of Zace, where you know your primary party member that you get introduced there is Tita, and then so you see a bit of the town, a little bit of the hot springs area, the little village that you go to. Some other relevant characters show up in this trailer, showing up their remake designs with Tita's grandpa Albert, then the guild receptionist Kilika. You have Sid and Gustav as well, who are involved in the Zace arc of that game. So that game still almost around the corner now. It's still September 19th, so still over a month away, but we're getting there. Everyone's eagerly anticipating it for those that played it. Then we also have here that... Fate Reawakened is now available on iOS and Android. That is the recent re-release of the
it's like 2000 series. Eras. It's like 2000, not that Fate series, the other Fate series. That, like 2000 yeah, eras,
Fate, older Fate series.
PC German dungeon crawlers or whatever they are. So
right, like I
pretty iconic.
They were like, I don't know if they were pre-installed in like some versions of Windows. I'm trying to remember, but they were definitely like. The original Fate game was
Windows
like,
Vista.
Yeah, I think that was it. So, no. And then, James, you mentioned this earlier, but the interactive adventure with the title Dear Me, I Was.
Dot, dot, dot. Very right. Important. There's the ellipses at the very end of the... is that ellipses?
Yes. From Arc System Works. It's coming on July 31st for Switch 2, and it's priced at $7.99 US dollars. So
I did not realize that we were covering this because
didn't know either, but I guess we are. Yeah. But it's fine, you know. We do adventure.
I pre-ordered it on the Japanese eShop. I wouldn't have done that if I knew we were covering this.
But either way, like anyone who's interested, it's $8. Yeah, if you're interested in checking it out, and have a Switch 2, definitely check it out. I definitely want to check it out. They do note, you know, because of the $8 price tag, they do say in the description that the estimated play time for this game is roughly 40 to 60 minutes, so it's not a long game.
Yeah, that seems fair though. I'm interested in it.
Yeah. So I didn't realize that it was just around the corner. It's gonna be out in a few days. So I'm like, oh, okay, cool.
Yep. I'll probably on my end, I'll probably stream like a playthrough of it and then figure out what else to play, because it's like a 40-minute stream is not a very long stream.
Yeah.
Probably check out a bit of East 10 Proud Nordic then, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Same day release.
We got a release date for Nicktoons and the Dice of Destiny. This was first showed off at SGF.
It's so funny whenever this shows up on our feed. It's like, and SpongeBob.
Right. It's coming out on September 30th for all platforms, modern platforms pretty much. They also had an extended trailer with more gameplay in it. The last time I checked this out was the debut, but they only had SpongeBob announced. Since then, they've, Mikhail, you've noted here, they've confirmed Sandy Cheeks with SpongeBob. You have Leonardo from TMNT, Katara from Avatar The Last Airbender, Timmy from Fairly Odd Parents, and then more to be revealed as well.
It's funny when we get like press release emails for this game, or at least I did, where it's like, announcement! We are excited to announce that Sandy Cheeks makes an appearance in Nicktoons.
Like, oh shit.
Hell yeah, Sandy. Everyone loves Sandy.
Look, I'm more excited with Timmy. Fairly Odd Parents was my jam. That was a great show. I love Fairly Odd Parents.
They're doing this pretty interesting thing with the key art where when they originally announced the game, they just had these question mark silhouettes on the cover on Steam and everything. And now they've revealed 2/3 of the silhouette. So I guess when they do their next announcement, everyone is going to be known for the key art for the game. So they're still keeping some things under wraps. I don't know who they'll have left, but yeah, Fairly Odd Parents. So I just joked about it when you posted the news for the announcement. I just posted saying SpongeBob on RPG site. The Nard was the Fairly Odd Parents on RPG set, so let's see who the third one is.
I think it's funny how we keep describing the game, which, to be fair, is how they describe it, as fantasy action.
Yeah.
I love fantasy action RPGs.
That's right.
When I think fantasy action, I think SpongeBob.
I mean, they're all dressed up in, like, fantasy classes. So yeah. Sure, why not? Yeah, it's fun. Hopefully it turns out to be a pretty cool, good game, because Game Mill Entertainment, not the greatest publisher with the greatest track record, let's say, but you know, once again, they're the publisher, not the developers, so hopefully this is cool. We got a release date for Borderlands 4 on the Nintendo Switch 2. This wasn't known before. This release date on other platforms besides the Switch 2 was September 12th. They have confirmed that Borderlands 4 for Switch 2 is coming October 3rd, so it'll be following the other releases of the game, just over a month after. Yeah. Well, under a month, rather. And this was announced via Randy Pitchford's social media. That's the way they decided to deliver the news.
Say what you will about Randy Pitchford, credit where credit is due for him being completely transparent about the state of the Switch 2 version, being like, it'll be mostly 30 FPS with dips if maybe like in heavy multiplayer or in handheld. And it's like, you know what?
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for the heads up. You know, that's appreciated. Not a lot of publishers and developers do that.
Yeah. I'm sure it'll be a better portable version of Borderlands 4 than Borderlands 2 was for that game on the Vita.
Yeah, I paid $40 for that.
It already will be better because it will have crossplay support, because it's the exact same game and not retooled with less enemy spawns to get it working on a portable system.
The Borderlands Remastered, I think they called it, then Borderlands 2 on Switch 1 were really good ports. Like, I played Borderlands 2 quite a bit on Switch 1. I didn't get Borderlands 3 yet, but I heard that was also a good port, and all of these were at 30 FPS. So I kind of figured Borderlands 4 would also be there. Maybe in handheld, if they run it at 120 Hertz, you can get low frame rate compensation with VRR, would be good, but remains to be seen.
Latency, yeah.
Yeah, someone asked me that, like just randomly on a Discord, they just said that, are you going to cover this and how are you going to cover it on both? And I was like, the staggered release is actually good because I can focus on like PC handhelds in September and then like switch to and compare it later. So that would be interesting if I end up doing that. But yeah, like excited to see how that ends up going.
We already did cover this earlier on the podcast about the Legend of Heroes Trails Beyond the Horizon is coming to North America and Europe on January 15, 2026. I just wanted to mention that like this is one of the slickest trailers that NISA has cut for the series. Like it is, it does a great job presenting the events of Trails Beyond the Horizon without necessarily spoiling it. Sometimes it feels like an impossible task, but this was one of the most impressive trailers they've done for this series.
Yeah, it's genuinely a really good trailer. It's cut really well. Like I said on Blue Sky, whoever did the trailer, they should get a raise. That genuinely, yeah, really good trailer. Really good.
Yeah, very good trailer. So that's almost there. For people who are waiting to get caught up, you're almost there. The wait is almost over. One hell of a game. And lastly here, the last thing that we have here, Typhoon Studio BB and Bandai Namco have announced that they are delaying the remake of Fate Extra, which is titled Fate Extra Record, from 2025 to spring 2026. They announced that they really wanted it to, wanted it out by 2025, but, unexpected things happened in the development, so now they have to kind of delay it a bit back to spring 2026. They also showed off some of the different editions that they're offering in Japan with the limited edition, the Asobi Store Special Edition, and another Super Special Edition. I think the talk about this one, when it hit the masses on the internet, was they had a key art to commemorate, I guess, to alongside the announcement of the delay, they released a new key art for the game, which is, it's a good key art from character designer Wada Arco, who has some of the ladies having a bit of a party going on there, and it looks great. Like you have Rin, you have Caster from and Saber from Fate Extra, along with another side character, chilling out there, and it looks great. And then it just shows Nero's bare feet in front of you, just straight up jump scaring the whole shot, and it's so prevalent. They're like, what is going on, man? So, and of course, people jokes like they apologized with Nero's feet, apology accepted. Like, yes, that's what they did pretty much. So, so it'll still be coming out, just they need a bit more time to cook it. And that's it. That's the news highlights and what we've been up to for this week. Ending it off on Nero's feet. And sometimes that's how the cookie crumbles, you can join us next week. I don't know exactly what we're going to be talking about next week, but
probably a Nintendo Direct.
Maybe. Who knows? Definitely a possibility. Until then, you can catch us over at our main site, rpgsite.net. You can find us on social media via at rpgsite. You can find us on Facebook through facebook.com/rpgsitenet. YouTube, you can find uploads of our podcast there, youtube.com/rpgsitenet. You can find us at your favorite podcast service, and you can join us over at Discord. Discord continuing to be very active. People kind of just enjoying their time there, talking about what RPGs they've been playing. A lot of talk about the 30th anniversary of Gundam Wing. So a lot of talk there on that. A lot of activity over obviously at the mobile game section of that. A lot of people still playing Uma Musume, Pretty Derby, and Fate Go. So, and that's gonna be actually a big weekend next week in terms of events, not outside of RPGs, but because you have Evo coming up next weekend, always a really, really, really exciting time for fighting game players on that front. Interested to see a lot of different things happening there. Of course, one of the main things that people are excited of is the debut gameplay of Marvel Tokkan. They're going to be showing off Marvel Tokkan there along the gameplay panel. Probably going to announce new characters for that there. Chow, I just saw that you got back. I was talking about that next week has a lot of interesting events. One of them is going to be Evo. Are you excited for Evo next weekend, Chow?
No, it's probably going to be Arxis work. Oh, they probably got to show them nothing but that Marvel game, which I don't care about.
You don't care about Marvel Tokkan? Oh, man.
Chow's probably excited for the 10th beta for 2XKO. I feel like it's been at Evo for the last 5 years and they just keep doing betas for it.
Yeah.
Like that game's never
gone. I mean, did you guys see that like clip that was going around this week where it's like, oh man, she's punching air?
I feel bad because they announced V as the newest playable character coming to 2XKO, Riot's upcoming fighting game based on ties in League of Legends. In V's gameplay trailer, one of her big supers was basically her doing a series of punches on the opponent, and there's fancy camera work zooming in on her, but like it doesn't really show the opponent getting punched, besides like a quick silhouette at the beginning and like at the end. So you know, social media kind of made fun of it. It's like, hey man, this super animation kind of lacks the sauce because it's just basically a camera zoom in of her doing a lot of like punches and you don't really see the opponent kind of getting hit in it. And you know, they made a lot of parodies out of that. Hopefully that's not final footage and they're gonna touch it up, you know, as the game evolves over time. Because, you know, it's understandably hard not to dunk on it because this game has been in development for a very long time and it's backed by a fucking multi-million, possibly billion.
I do feel really, really bad about it though, because for some context, back in 2019, Riot opened up their campus for one day, just completely randomly, for an undernight in-birth local. So I actually went and with a bunch of other people at the time in the undernight like LA community, and there was a local that they just opened up their campus for. And I was sure, like, after that they would stick the landing. Not so sure now, but it's like, I've been rooting for it since then, because it's like, that, to me, seemed like a pretty good gesture of goodwill towards the community and, like, a statement of intent. It's like, oh, I don't know if the same people that decided that are even there, probably not, but it's, yeah, it's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's also kind of a weird spot, because it's been a developer for so long that there's now a new wave of tag fighting games coming out that they have to directly compete with. You know, of course, Hunter Net Impact kind of released not in a great state. I mean, it does have some funny things going on with it, but seems like it didn't stick the landing. You have Invincible Versus coming out from the Killer Instinct, a lot of Killer Instinct alumni working on that. And obviously Marvel Tokkan is the juggernaut amongst us all, you know, with Arc System Works making a 4v4 tag fighter on this. We'll see. Besides Evo, they also have the Fate Grand Order 10th anniversary event going on in Japan. Like, they have a whole like actual physical event commemorating like each anniversary of Fate Go for quite a while now. Usually, obviously, most of that's gonna be Fate Grand Order focus, but there are some other Type Moon related projects that get either get updates or news announcements there. So the next Type Moon Times stream is going to be held during there, and the focus of that is going to be Fate Hollow Ataraxia Remastered, and that will probably get a release date there. So I'm very, 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 very excited for that. I'm almost done with my Fate Stay Night Heaven's Feel playthrough, so I'll be well prepared actually for it. I'll be done with my rereads of all the routes in Fate Stay Night, so I'm excited for that, primarily for Fate Hollow Ataraxia. So that's what's I'm looking forward to next weekend. It's gonna be fun. We'll see what other games we have in store that we'll be talking about. I'm sure we'll be talking about Dear Me I Was... And we'll see what else will happen. Until then, thank you for listening up until this point, and we'll have the usual crew back all together next week. So stay safe, take care. You know, it's a lot going on out there, and you know, just take care of yourself. Until then, see you later.